All right, we seem to be at critical mass of regional stakeholder group members and an I-team staff. We could. It's not necessary. It's not necessary. Special thanks to the work teams that labored last night and this morning. Very productive sessions. A little wrap-up still in progress, not surprisingly. And we have a very full agenda today, so as we settle in, I'd just like to welcome you to this meeting of the North Coast Regional Stakeholder Group. This meeting is rather an important midpoint, really, of our process. Recall that we set up this iterative process where draft options for a raise begin with the regional stakeholder group. They get SAT evaluation, BRTF guidance. You've now had a round of that, and we're back to the regional stakeholder groups. So that's the context of that we're working in today. And I want to just begin by asking Ken Wiseman to share with us a couple of announcements about logistics and special guests we're expecting.
Thank you, Scott. I regret that Chair Golding, who was scheduled to be here this afternoon, has come down with the flu and got a fever and called and sounded awful, but regrets that she will not be able to be here as planned. We will have Meg Caldwell, a fellow member of the Blue Ribbon Task Force, who will join us this evening. So we do continue to like to have a member of our Blue Ribbon Task Force. We also continue to have a representative of the Fish and Game Commission. Adriana Shea is here as the Deputy Executive Director, so both the task force and the commission are represented. And for those of you who may not have heard, we do have a joint meeting scheduled February 13th with both the commission and Blue Ribbon Task Force in attendance. Housekeeping here, if some of you made reservations or had dinner here last night outside of our auspices, if you'd let Delbra know so we can get credit for that, that helps us defray the cost of the facility. So if you did make your reservation, we try to do it through our central process, but if you handled it separately, make sure Delbra knows so we can get credit for that. I have had some requests, why can't we see the ocean? And our video friends tell us that we look like we're all in witness protection programs on the screen. So we will open them up when we're offline or on the call.
Ken, I thought we were.
Oh, well, yeah, it's just an added screen. Anyway, thank you all for being here.
What we'd like to do is we recognize that we have a lot of members of the public here today, so let me make a couple of opening statements about where we are in the process. As many of you know, we have presently 9 or 10 draft options for a raise and draft proposals, and we are going to be talking about those and refining them today and tomorrow. Again, this is a midpoint in the process. Those of you who saw an early agenda may have noticed that public comment was agendized for 1 o'clock. We forecast that our morning is going to be a little denser than we thought, so we have public comment set for 1:15, and we will do our very best to hew to that. What I'd like to do is to begin with an overview of objectives for the meeting. Then we'll go around the table and invite RSG members to introduce themselves. We'll then hear from alternates and members of the public, and then we'll come back and give you a bit more of a briefing about where we stand in the process and the steps that we see. So meeting objectives include, first of all, receiving a number of informational presentations. We're still wanting to provide the regional stakeholder group with the best available information, and a few new information sets have come available, actually, since your last RSG meeting, and so we want to provide those to you. We also want to receive a presentation of the revised external MPA proposals. These are external to the work team process. We have quite a good-sized chunk of time set up for extended work team activities, and in fact, two of the work teams met last night and again this morning, so they've been working very hard to respond to the SAT, BRTF, and Fish and Game Department feedback and you'll hear about their progress. And we are intending to use a mix of deliberation and straw voting to identify no more than 5 arrays for the next round of review and evaluation. After we do introductions around the room, we'll tell you a bit more about the game plan for that process. We also have experienced a very heavy volume of email traffic, and to that end, the I-team wants to propose adoption of an additional ground rule to really focus the RSG on its key charge as it uses that tool. So that's an additional meeting objective. So with that, let's turn to introductions. I'm Scott McCreary, principal of Concur, one of the co-facilitators. Let's hear from Eric, and then we'll go back to my left.
Thanks. Up, Eric Ponsley from Concur, also co-facilitator.
Mary Gleason with the MLPA Initiative. Melissa Miller-Henson with the MLPA Initiative.
Ken Wiseman with the Initiative.
Susan Ashcraft, California Department of Fish and Game.
Jason Vasquez, California Department of Fish and Game.
Evan Fox, MLPA Initiative.
Bill Bernard, the Abalone Advisory Group.
Bob Breen, Half Moon Bay High School and former ranger at the Fitzgerald Marine Museum.
Josh Churchman, optimistic fisherman.
Henry Fastenau, University of California, Davis.
Ellen Farrow Daniels with the Energy, Ocean Resources, and Federal Consistency Division of the California Coastal Commission.
Karen Garrison, NRDC.
Aaron Golbus, Port of San Francisco.
Ken Jones, United Pier and Shore Anglers of California.
Francesca Coe, dive instructor and dive operator.
Irina Kogan, Gulf of the Farallones Marine Sanctuary.
Mike McHenry, representing the California wet fish industry.
John Miller, commercial fisherman.
Let's use the mic, please.
That was Craig Merrilies, sport fisherman.
Samantha Murray, Ocean Conservancy.
Calix Nelson, San Mateo County Resource Conservation District, abalone diver and scuba diver.
Don Neubacher, National Park Service.
Shancy Roberts with Oceana.
Ben Slater, Coastside Fishing Club.
Frederick Smith, Environmental Action Committee of West Marin.
Craig Swalgard, California State Parks.
Ed Tavazzi, a commercial fisherman, owner of California Fresh Fish, and the Secretary of the Fisheries Enhancement and Research Foundation.
Jay Okamizo, charter boat operator, Golden Gate Sport Fishing Association.
Thanks, Jay. Tom, back to you.
Tom Beatty, fisherman.
Ben Becker, National Park Service.
Richard Charter, Defenders of Wildlife.
Neil Desai, National Parks Conservation Association.
Tom Estes, commercial fisherman.
Russ Herring, Secretary Treasurer, SB Sinkers Fishing Club.
Jim Hobbs, recreational kayaker.
Rick Johnson, volunteer docent, trip leader.
Tom Matush, Woolly Cat Sport Fishing and Whale Watching.
Okay, let's jump back to the staff table here. If we can have the mic, please.
Matt Merrifield, Geographic Information Systems Analyst for the I-Team.
Will McClintock, Director of Marine Map, UC Santa Barbara.
Chad Miller, Department of Fish and Game, GIS Support.
Okay, and then back up to the row just behind the main table. One row forward, please. Thank you.
Paul Pierce, Coastside Fishing Club.
Karen Reina, Gulf of the Farallones National Marine Sanctuary.
Philip Sanders, California Abalone Association.
Dave Schaub, State Parks.
Cassidy Teufel, California Coastal Commission.
Nick Tippon, alternate for the Native American representative.
Bob Wilson, the Marine Mammal Center.
Dave Yarger, Fishermen's Marketing Association, Bodega Bay.
Good. Let's continue around the members of the public, please.
Sure. Dan Wolford with the Coastside Fishing Club.
Lori Schuyler, Havens Neck Preserve.
Clive Endress, Havens Neck Preserve.
Nancy Ratcliffe, Sail Rock Ranch, LLC.
Walter Ratcliffe, Sail Rock Ranch.
Peter Ratcliffe, Sail Rock Ranch.
Bob Bramley, commercial fisherman, San Francisco.
William Smith, CPFV vessel Riptide out of Half Moon Bay.
Matt Keller, commercial fisherman, Bodega Bay.
Tim Fromm, Half Moon Bay, Native Sons of the Golden West.
Sarah Allen, National Park Service.
John Zeisig, United Pure and Sure Anglers, California.
Hi, I'm Mike Hardy. I'm the Lessons Learned Evaluator for the initiative.
Jessica Liu, Point Reyes National Seashore Association.
Lynn Takata, California Department of Fish and Game.
Paul Riley, Department of Fish and Game.
Mike Flynn, Island Cove Estates, Point Arena.
Kevin Klein, Independent Coast Observer.
Angela Herron, California Coast Keeper Alliance.
Kira Redmond, Santa Barbara Channel Keeper.
Jerry Norton, some experience in marine science. And if you're interested, it's looking like the ocean's going to be better for salmon next year, if anybody's interested in that. Anyway, partner in the Anchor Bay LLC.
Thanks.
Dave Fox, Fish and Game.
Adriana Shea, Commission.
Peggy Hill, Commercial Fisherman.
Ken Hill, Commercial Fisherman, out of Alameda.
Good. Thank you. Have we missed any introductions? Okay. We would like to pick up where we left off on November 28th. Recall that we had a meeting not so many days ago. And what we would like to do is orient the members of the RSG as to where they are in the process and then acquaint you with the flow of the next 2 days. So, Eric, do you want to take a cut at the charge here?
So we have a couple of slides here where we're going to just repeat for you guys the considerations that we took into consideration as we came up with the process design for this two-day meeting, and then, as Scott said, go over the flow and hit a couple of other agenda key points. Your charge is several-fold for this meeting. By the end of the meeting, we are asking RSG members to produce draft MPA proposals. And these proposals are expected to be a fully developed arrays that take into account recent feedback from the SAT, BRTF, and the Department of Fish and Game. And this is different from what we did in Gualala, where we were still inventing and putting ideas on the table, and we're asking you guys now to put together entire arrays that fit together and meet the goals of the Act and the guidance. We're asking you in developing these draft MP proposals over the next 2 days to evaluate both the draft options that the workgroups produced last time as well as the proposals developed external to the workgroup process. So that there are these 10 arrays Scott mentioned before. They're on the table. A lot of information has come back from the department and the SAT. And so we are asking you to take all of those pieces of information into consideration. Importantly, we want to highlight that at their last meeting, the BRTF has asked that the RSG forward no more than 5 draft proposals to the next round of review and evaluation. And so we've designed a process that will help you guys reduce the total number of arrays to go forward to no more than 5. And I want to reiterate that Scott said we're in the middle of this process, and indeed we're looking today and tomorrow to produce draft MPA proposals. I want to just remind you guys that these are still drafts. These are not your final proposals. You'll be producing those by the end of the meeting on your next meeting, your next full two-day meeting, which will be March 18th and 19th. We also want to acknowledge that at the November 28th meeting, we heard a number of process design suggestions from RSG members. In particular, we heard from you the general desire to continue with the workgroup format and to give you guys time to try to converge on single arrays. At the same time, we also heard that you guys also needed more time in plenary to discuss. And so we've tried to combine both of those into the schedule for today and tomorrow. So there are two main ways by which our process will enable you guys to converge to a number of no more than 5 draft proposals to move forward or total arrays to move forward for future evaluation. And one is convergence within the work groups themselves, and the second is using straw voting as a tool for winnowing. And I want to talk about both of these briefly. Convergence can be accomplished in a number of different ways, and you guys have, by and large, already been doing these. You can converge between the internal array options that you worked on last time, the A and B within the individual work groups. You can converge between arrays developed in one group and those developed in another work group. You can also converge between the draft options within the work groups and the external proposals that have been developed at the same time. And we also want to acknowledge that while we're asking each of the work groups to attempt to converge by the end of this meeting, that is possible that you may not be able to do so. At the same time, we're acknowledging that you may actually be able to produce important information regarding individual sections of your arrays, of your MPA suites, and that this might also be very important information to keep bringing on in the process. Straw voting is, I think, a very important tool that we're going to be using to help winnow the number of arrays, if indeed we have more than five coming into midday tomorrow. We have the option of using straw voting to help reduce that number to five.
So let me be more explicit about this. Work teams that converge will have their converged option move forward into the next round of evaluation. If work teams don't converge, they go into a pool. And the pool will be the focus of the straw voting that we'll do tomorrow afternoon. So there are ways of making sure that your proposal is evaluated in the next round. And so what we're trying to do very explicitly here is to create an incentive to converge. And I want to be very clear about that at the outset of the meeting. So we're building in considerable time for work team deliberation. I'm sure there's going to be offline caucusing, and there has been, I know, even this morning. But tomorrow afternoon, if we have more than five, we will structure a straw vote. And the number, if we have, for example, two converged options that come out of the deliberations, then we'll use a straw vote with the remaining eight, if there are eight, and the top three will join the first two, and that's how we'll arrive at our five. So that's the game plan that we're going to use here.
Thanks, Scott. A couple more process design considerations. One is that you're being asked to include additional information in your draft MPA proposals this time than you did before, and we're asking you to include specific objectives for each of the individual MPAs. And so want to make sure that we leave time to do that, and want to highlight that obviously we don't have a large amount of time to do all this work over the next 2 days, and so we really don't have time to do the kind of inventing that we did last time, and we're really asking you guys to really focus hard on the vast amount of work that has been done to date and the feedback that you've received and have very focused discussions based on that. So process flow. Scott just described this again, two different ways of coming down to no more than five proposals. Again, if work groups converge on a single array, that array automatically will go forward for evaluation in the next round. We also will then use straw voting if there are more than five on the table at that point to winnow the rest down to a total number of five. So here's the process flow for the next 2 days. We're going to spend the morning in plenary receiving informational presentations in our effort to bring you guys the best available information. In the afternoon, we will start with public comment, and then we will break out into work groups, and you will spend the rest of your work groups, the rest of the afternoon through 6 o'clock, working in your work group setting. The goal in this period of time is to come as close as you can and ideally come up with a single array that everyone in the work group agrees with at that point. In the evening, we're going to shift into plenary mode. So we'll actually have at 6 o'clock four RSG members, heavy hors d'oeuvres, available in the hotel here. I'll tell you more about that later. And then at 7, we'll move into what we've designed as a poster session, where you'll have three different areas. This room here, the Sea Witch room next door, and I believe special suite 434, the presidential suite upstairs. And each of these three rooms will have a screen and a projector and a small and a portion of a work group that will present to others what they've developed over the course of the day. And so we're expecting that the other two work groups will send emissaries, so to speak, to these other posters to hear these presentations and then to have time to provide feedback to them. And we will do this in two rounds so that the work group members who are visiting the other posters, so to speak, will have a chance to see both of the other ones. And so the timing will be such that you will have about 15 minutes of presentations followed by about half hour or so of comments, and then we'll switch. So that's today. Tomorrow morning, and during this, the poster sessions, staff will be helping the work groups to capture the comments being made by the members of the other work groups. And so then the work groups will reconvene the next morning at 8 o'clock, and what you'll be doing at that point is saying, well, you know, for those who stayed at home with the poster, let's talk about what we heard from the other members of the RSG and how can we refine and revise our arrays in order to accommodate and incorporate those comments. And we'll spend nearly all of the morning doing that. We want to make sure that we take at least a half hour at the end of the morning for staff to make sure that we have all the information loaded correctly into both the template forms on the computer and into the GIS. And so there will be a little bit of a house cleaning step there. Because, again, at the end of this meeting, what moves forward at the end of this meeting is what goes forward. There will not be opportunities to revise after this point for this round. In the afternoon, after lunch, we will give the opportunity for the work groups to present where they've arrived at the end of the mornings to the full plenary again, and we'll have a plenary discussion on what came out of this. And we're, I think, in particular, interested in the cross-cutting observations that you will to share with others based upon what you've seen come out of all three work groups. If needed, straw voting will take place in the afternoon, and we will design a paper ballot that we would use to do the straw voting. Bear in mind that it will take a little bit of time to set up the ballot depending on how many arrays will be up for voting, and then it will take a little bit of time to tally the voting afterwards. So we'll likely schedule a break prior to and a break after doing the voting itself. And when you guys do vote, we will provide you with template information for all of the arrays that are on the table for the straw voting. Okay, so the next two slides are just the agenda. I just want to highlight again that we are looking at public comment today at 1:15. Importantly, and tomorrow the public comment is scheduled for 12:30, and we'll do as best we can to keep to those schedules. Okay.
So just want to reiterate, as Eric said a couple of minutes ago, there are many different ways by which these arrays and proposals can converge. They can converge within work teams, across work teams, between external arrays, or it may be that proponents decide that their draft ideas are just that, their draft ideas, and they become components of other proposals. So there are numbers of ways that we can go about accomplishing this convergence that the BRTF has asked us to try and achieve this meeting. So with that, we have a series of presentations, and I think up first, Melissa, you want to acquaint us. Oh, ground rules. Sorry. Even more current. I mentioned in my introduction that we've had a vast flurry, a blizzard, really, of email. Melissa mentioned at the last meeting she gets 200 to 300 a day. We're not sure how many of these are from the GEMS work groups, but maybe a half. And so Eric wants to outline a proposed ground rule that we would like to ask for you to consider and adopt as an addition to the ground rules that we've already adopted here as an RSG.
So everyone should have received in their agenda packet that went out late last week the proposed ground rules here. We've crafted these to address just the vast number of emails that are going around. We have found, and I think this is shared by RSG members, that the listservs have been very helpful, that they've really enabled RSG members within the work groups and across the GEMS to do meaningful work in communication offline. However, there have been instances where some RSG members and staff have questioned whether it was the best use of these listservs. And so we've crafted these in the spirit of encouraging that really helpful communication that has been taking place, while at the same time, you know, limiting the bounds of, you know, the communication that will be taking place in the future. So to hit a couple of points here, again, the listservs are intended for asking and answering factual questions related to the initiative, exchanging ideas about MPAs, doing the work group work that you guys have been up to date. The ground rule is noting that RSG members would be agreeing that the messages to the list would remain on point to the charge of the RSG. So keep them focused in that way. Thirdly, we ask that you keep your messages relatively short and include a statement of what you expect recipients to do with the information. So make very good use of the subject line, and early on in the email, identify who it's for and what you want to get out of it. And so that people who are seeing these emails can look at them quickly and have a targeted response. Again, if your email is for one person only, send it to that person. If it's for your work group only, send it to the work group. If it's for the GEMS in total, send it to that group as appropriate. Staff does not intend to moderate the listservs, and we have not done that in a dedicated way to date. It takes, obviously, an awful lot of time, and we're trying to use staff resources as efficiently as possible to help support you. But we will be checking in periodically and listening to the pulse of the broader RSG to make sure that the listservs are used as effectively as possible. And we, again, ask for your own help in self-moderating. So is there a question up, Bill?
The question wasn't regarding the listserv. Actually, the question was about the straw voting. What is the
okay, let's go okay. Back to that in a second. So we want to actually are there any questions about this ground rule now? Josh.
Well, I could probably end half of the emails if I just quit sending them. I have to say, my first email I ever sent was at the beginning of this thing, and I thought it was a great tool. I promised to amend my evil ways. End the story.
Josh, do I assume that that means you will vote for adoption of these fair and reasonable ground rules? Good. All right. Other comments on ground rules?
Good. We have tried to make them fair and reasonable. Ken?
In the spirit of contriteness, since Josh's 900 emails and my 1,473 have probably clogged a lot of email boxes, we certainly can go along with this. I do think the one thing I was concerned about when I read these was the I think early on it said something about two paragraphs or something of that nature. We've received, I think, to date about four binders worth of data, which I think is tremendous. And I think you guys have done a tremendous job getting us as much information as possible to answer these questions. However, it's also been apparent over the months that we've been on this that a lot of good information also came from fellow members. And so we certainly, I'm sure Josh and I both, will cut down our number of emails. But when we do come up with good data that we think is useful, I hope we can still submit that and do so in a, you know, well-mannered way.
You bet. And the ground rule says that it says that you'll keep the messages short to a paragraph or two unless more is necessary to address an issue. So acknowledging that may happen. So being that I don't see any of the comments up, I'd like to see a show of hands of folks who would like to adopt these ground rules. Anyone opposed, since I didn't see all of the hands? Okay, good. So what we will do is we will actually revise your existing set of ground rules, add these to it, and send that out to you following this meeting.
With respect to the straw voting and that process, we will describe that in much more detail tomorrow. But we really want to encourage the convergence that we think can happen through deliberation. So
yeah, hopefully we won't even have to describe that much.
In a perfect world, we will have deliberation and five. So I'd like to defer those questions till tomorrow. Ed?
Yeah, back into the pool that we're talking about. If a group has
enters the pool, they don't have consensus. And the pool, basically they lose in the pool. Will that group be assimilated by other two groups?
Well, that sort of goes to the question is, do the work teams have a life after the end of tomorrow? And we don't want to prejudge that. But without a doubt, I don't know, you can't be in two places at once, but I have been roving over the last, you know, two-thirds of a day, and there's already a lot of cross-pollination happening across the work groups and sharing of ideas. And so certainly the intent is to consider the various elements of the proposals or options to be building blocks and to share those, and the ideas, most importantly, and the interests they represent certainly will be shared and, as you say, assimilated or incorporated. So that is the intent.
It's more theoretical than factual.
Yeah, the idea is not to exclude any good ideas or any interests here. Tom.
Just a quick one. Will the alternates be included in that straw voting process?
We will describe the caucusing opportunities for between alternates and primaries tomorrow as to how that how alternates enter the straw voting process.
So we don't know that now.
Let me be more explicit. The thinking is that we will invite primaries and alternates to caucus before the straw vote, and the primaries will take part in the straw vote.
Okay.
This is consistent with the approach we used in the Central Coast and consistent with the term primary and alternate. So we're comfortable with that arrangement.
And one caveat there is if your primary is not in attendance, then the alternate would vote in the primary stead.
I would really like to ask RSG members not to get hung up on straw voting ground rules right now, because that really is not today's topic. So I would like you to sort of self-monitor your questions that you might have on that. Ellen.
So you may have covered this, and maybe I'm just not clear, but it sounds as though, I mean, it's clear that you want no more than five proposals.
That's the guidance that we have.
But it almost sounds as though you want at least five proposals. I was hoping that in plenary we could even winnow them down further if there's an opportunity to converge,
yes.
And I'm just not quite hearing how we do that.
We chose our words carefully, and I think the operative phrase, Melissa, is no more than five. We would be delighted if in work team deliberations and in plenary and through offline conversations, the number of proposals can be winnowed down to three or four. But we're setting five as a ceiling. It's not a target, though. If we come up with three or four that we all like, terrific. Ken.
Just clarification. When you said convergence, let's say, for instance, Emerald has A and B. They converge down into one proposal for a raise. That will go forward or not go forward?
Yes,
okay.
It will. Good. Okay. With that, Melissa, I believe we're ready to hear about our updated schedule.
So in the briefing packet that you just received this morning, the first item underneath the ground rule should be the revised meeting schedule. For, as you may recall, 2008, we completely rescheduled from January 9 on. And so after today's meeting of the regional stakeholder group, the science advisory team will meet on January 8. That meeting is not for evaluating packages or draft MPA proposals, as was previously scheduled. Rather, that meeting will be used for primarily the parallel processes work group and evaluating those various models that are being considered by the science advisory team. There will be some other discussion topics, but that will be the primary focus. And instead, the analysis of draft proposals will be on the 23rd of January, followed by some public workshops. Ken mentioned earlier the Blue Ribbon Task Force meeting, February 13, 14. The first day of that meeting will be jointly with the Fish and Game Commission. And then this group will meet again on the 18th and 19th of March. And then again, we'll go through that evaluation iteration between the SAT, DFG, Blue Ribbon Task Force, and then ultimately the task force will make a recommendation to the commission. So I think it's pretty straightforward unless you have any questions.
And Melissa, just a clarification, this updated schedule is available online, is that correct?
It is available online.
Good.
And also, just as a reminder, I think this group is aware, but maybe for members of the public or folks who are watching online, one of the main reasons for these date changes was because we wanted to build in a little bit more time for this group to have opportunity for deliberation, work group sessions, interactions with the public, et cetera, before your next meeting, and build in a little more time for SAT analysis as well and not ruin everyone's holidays.
Right. So it sounds like someone has a BlackBerry or iPhone on. I'm not sure if they do. Obviously, we're concerned about drawing on our lessons from the Central Coast, and really embedded in this schedule that Melissa just outlined is, in fact, a whole other cycle of RSG development of proposals, SAT review, and BRTF evaluation. So we really are trying to learn from and build on that Central Coast experience. Ed.
Melissa, on the work group sessions, the workshops, perhaps for clarification for the public, you could distinguish what the kind of input that the public can give in these workshops. And that has to do with their input towards ERAs so that they understand what these workshops are about.
Just as you described, they're really an opportunity for members of the public to come in and sit down with staff, members of the science advisory team potentially, members of the regional stakeholder group who would like to participate, and learn more about these draft proposals that are being suggested at that point in time, recognizing that there's one more iteration. But this is really an important opportunity for the public to have direct interaction with staff and stakeholders for potentially amending or at least making suggestions for amendments to those draft proposals.
And what's different about those dates in February and today is that by that date in February, you and members of the public will have the benefit of both the SAT evaluation and the BRTF review. So we will have gone through a whole other cycle by then.
As well as the Department of Fish and Game feasibility analysis.
As well as the department.
Right. I just want to make sure the public understood what the workshops were about.
Good. Thanks, Ed. Good clarifying question. Let us move on to our next briefing, and that is an update on socioeconomic data. And Susan Ashcraft is going to present that.
Yes, this is very brief. I wanted to let you know that we do now have copies of the maps from the recreational socioeconomic spatial information that EcoTrust has collected. I have one packet of the maps for each of the work groups to peruse, and by this afternoon we'll also have the updated commercial ones. But the recreational ones, there's a memo on the front from EcoTrust to the initiative staff, and explaining some of the caveats to consider when you're looking at the data. So we'll go over those briefly at the beginning of the work session so that you're clear on that. And then we'll be, again, collecting these confidential information at the end of the work session.
That was it?
That
was very brief, Susan.
You said 1 to 2 minutes.
That was great. Okay. Jason Vasquez now has a briefing on the November 29th SAT meeting. And this keys to a handout.
Thank you. And so just before I get into the last SAT meeting, I want to make note that included in your briefing packet, some of your handouts are responses to questions that you've had. Just note that the July meeting and the additional set of questions were passed out at your last RSG meeting on the 28th. You now have in front of you the August 22nd to 23rd meeting questions. Most of those were preliminarily approved pending some minor revisions. There's a couple tweaks to revisions that staff is still making, but by and large those responses have been approved by the full SAT. And you also have some staff responses to questions that were posed at the October meeting. SAT's still working on providing responses to most of those questions. They've been swamped with end of semester and evaluation projects as well. So at the November 29th meeting, this was a teleconference and web conference, and that meeting was dedicated to the parallel processes part of this, which is the different models. And we heard from each of the modelers on population dynamics models as well as optimization models. And from that, the SAT and the Parallel Processes Work Group have decided to come together and present at the January 8th meeting a synthesis of a single species model, one of the optimization models, which is similar to the ecospace model, and they're going to continue discussions about folding in some of the population dynamics parameters into Marksan and determining how that's useful. And at that January 8th meeting, they'll discuss how to provide those results to the RSG and the BRTF and how best to present those. They'll be working on a fact sheet that is sort of a one-page synopsis of what each of those are. Further, at the the next meeting, the January 8th meeting, they'll continue some discussions about the evaluation methods and the levels and protections and those things.
And Jason, the venue for that meeting is again the San Francisco Airport. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay. Great. Thanks. Next up, we have Evan and Susan with an update on the staff summary of the SAT analyses. Evan.
Great. Thanks, Scott. So seeing the large amount of information the RSG had to absorb last week before this meeting, the IT team thought that we'd put together a summary of some of the observations that we've made with regard to how some of the internal arrays fared in the SAT analysis. So this is not meant to be any kind of prescriptive document. It just is showing you the kinds of information that you can glean from the SAT analyses. So we put that document out, and sometime in the middle of last week, there was an error identified in the spacing analysis that was done, and we corrected our summary based on those new data. So last Friday, you should have received a memo describing the error that was made and a revised version of that iTeam summary of SAT analyses.
Great. Thanks very much. And Susan, I think you wanted to add one point here on inshore, offshore.
If I could just add one more thing just to what Evan said, is we also provided a revised version of the spacing analysis that Steve Gaines helped us with. That should also be in your packet, so revised bar charts that show spacing gaps among the different proposals.
Good. Susan.
Okay. I've been trying to think through some of the key concerns that some individuals have articulated, in particular some of the nearshore activities such as abalone, nearshore rockfish fishing, and then the pier and shore-based fishermen leading to the ribbon kind of discussion. And since you're now moving into formalizing draft proposals, I wanted to, and I know that we don't have a lot of time to invent new things, but I want to encourage you, I want to remind you of one of the recommendations that the department had suggested, because it could help to address some of those needs. Most of the SMRs and SMCAs are oriented as nearshore, shoreward state marine reserves and seaward state marine conservation areas. And there are very few that are oriented with a north and south orientation. And so I wanted to encourage you to contemplate that, because there's the needs of the pelagics fisheries has been well recognized in the seaward shoreward orientation of SMRs and SMCAs. What I still have heard a lot of responses back that there's needs to balance that with the considerations of the nearshore rockfish fishery, the pier and shore-based anglers, and so on. And one option that could help to balance that, those considerations, could be a reorientation of some of the priority areas for those fisheries to a north and south orientation. I just want to throw that out there for you guys to think about, because there are there may be places where one set of fisheries and fishing activities is a higher priority than others, and you can discuss those trade-offs. But this would kind of be the day that could happen, really. So.
Good. Thanks. So that concept could be designed into the new proposals. Thank you, Susan. So we still have several more informational presentations. Mary Gleason is going to fill us in on the Goal 3 evaluation.
Okay. Thanks. Yes, Susan wants to say one more thing. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I really should have said that the reason that it was shown as a preferred in the DFD feasibility analysis is because that is much easier for enforcement and it's clearer understanding for the public. It wasn't because of fishery trade-offs or anything like that. So just to make that clear, but I also saw some added potential there for how it could frame your trade-off dialogue.
Thank you.
Mary. Okay, so moving on to the Goal 3 evaluation. You have a document in your packet. It's a memo from the I-team called the Goal 3 evaluation. I'm going to go through this very quickly, and you can look at this in more detail later. But essentially, just remind you that Goal 3 is really focused on improving recreational, educational, and study opportunities provided by marine ecosystems that are subject to minimal disturbance. And so the staff essentially looked at ways to evaluate how well the different draft options and proposals were meeting this goal and really focused on evaluating six different parameters. And I'll just go through these pretty quickly. The parameters really focus primarily on access, accessibility, and proximity to research institutions and the presence of existing monitoring sites and things like that. So it's a very sort of qualitative evaluation. There's no thresholds or benchmarks for any of these parameters. We're really, again, just ranking, comparing the proposals against one another relative to these parameters. So the first one focuses on the number of access points within or near proposed MPAs, near being within 2 miles. And again, accessibility is a key factor in your discussions. And again, just to note that a high number of access points is not necessarily a good thing if you're proposing activities that restrict certain fisheries and yet those areas are accessible to the public that have been engaged in those fisheries. So access can go both ways. It can be a positive or a negative thing depending on what your intent is with different MPAs. The second parameter really focused on distance of proposed MPAs to boat ramps, launches, and ports. And again, this is just another way to look at accessibility. And again, you know, all of the proposals had MPAs that were both near and far from ports. And again, proximity to ports can be a good thing if you're looking for access, or it can be not such a good thing if you're going to be restricting activities to small boat fishermen that are coming out of those ports or launches. The third parameter was distance of proposed MPAs from just the major ports in the region. So really just looking at Bodega, San Francisco, and Half Moon Bay, and just really trying to identify proximity of MPAs to those major ports. And again, the proposals vary amongst each other, but again, there's no prescriptive amount or threshold here. The fourth parameter was looking at the distance of proposed MPAs from major marine research institutions, and we really just counted Bodega Marine Lab and Tiburon as the two institutions here. And again, just expecting that a lot of the research focused on MPAs might be originating from some of those local institutions. And then the fifth parameter identified the number of long-term marine research monitoring sites, which was primarily the PSCO sites inside MPAs of different protection level. And so, again, this just compares across all the packages. You can see that they all include, at least a few, and in some cases quite a few, existing monitoring sites. And then the last parameter was replication of habitats within the study region. And, okay, I just, first of all want to clarify that this is not the same thing as replication within the biogeographic region, which is going to be evaluated in the context of Goal 4 by the SAT. And that's kind of looking, again, at the whole bioregion from point conception up to Oregon. This is really just focused on, for your benefit, identifying the replication of habitats within the study region, and that's primarily for a research and educational design perspective. If you're going to be focusing research on MPAs in the region, you might want to have replicate MPAs of different types with habitats that you can design your research around. So again, it's just looking across the packages and comparing among them. So those are all fairly basic patterns related to accessibility. We are planning to do some additional analysis in this next round. We were waiting for the EcoTrust recreational data to come in, and so there will be an EcoTrust evaluation of potential impacts to recreational fisheries that they focus on in their surveys as part of the next evaluation process. And then the department is also going to be doing an evaluation of potential impact to the abalone fishery in particular based on looking at the, you know, the number of abalone index sites or harvest sites or the amount of landings that are impacted by different proposals. So there will be two additional components of the Goal 3 analysis. And we encourage you, if you have any other ideas of parameters relative to Goal 3 that you think would be useful in your deliberations, to let us know, and we'll try to work them in.
Great. Thanks very much, Mary. Heads up to the RSG. What I'm going to ask I-Team staff to do is to step through the next three presentations, and then we'll consider if there are any questions on any of the of this group of presentations. So next up, we have the I-Team has been working hard over the last 4 to 6 weeks in particular to try to mobilize more information about tribal uses, and Mary Gleason is going to make a presentation about progress on that so far.
Okay, I'm going to make a short presentation and invite Nick to join in if he has any comments at the end. Nelson, unfortunately, wasn't able to be here, but we've been working very closely with the tribal reps to get their assistance in helping us bring a little bit more information to bear on your planning process. I just wanted to orient you in your packet. There's a set of maps that are called Some Important Use Areas for Native American Tribes. It's definitely a draft format of a map, but you might pull those out and take a look at them. Just to reiterate sort of the purpose of this effort was really to develop a data set, a spatial data set for tribal uses that would help inform your MPA planning process and to help the tribal representatives bring this information into the process. There's only two of them, and it's been, I think, hard for them to get all that information out to you. And then, you know, also an attempt to build a collaborative relationship with some of these traditional cultural users in the region, because they are a very diverse group, and, you know, not all of their interests are well represented here. So that was the intent. You know, as you might recall, we've talked about this a bit in the past. There are essentially three main tribes that have a presence on the coast, the Pomo, Miwok, and Ohlone. And, you know, we consider the tribal uses, traditional uses of marine resources in the region to be an important consideration, one that's not been brought forward a lot. We certainly have been lacking spatial data and information on where these cultural uses occur and what types of resources are collected. And, again, it's a very diverse group, and Nelson and Nick have done a great job representing them, but they have a hard job in that they're representing a lot of different users in the region. So we have been conducting some outreach to the tribal community with the help of the tribal reps and really organized one information sharing workshop, which was held in Healdsburg. There were about 25 people there. And it was really a knowledge exchange. The I-Team spent a lot of time just sharing with the tribal members what the purpose of the MLPA is, what the planning process is that we're undergoing right now, what its potential impact to some of their uses might be, and really just informing them about the MLPA. They also then shared their thoughts with us about the process, not always positive, as you might imagine. They described some of their types of historic and cultural uses that might be impacted by potential MPAs, and we're definitely wanting to make sure that their uses were not impacted adversely. So we, in this workshop, asked them to help us map and identify some of these areas of importance. And they initially expressed, you know, some reservations just primarily because of the difficulty of the task. I mean, they essentially really identify the entire coastline as being important culturally for their traditional uses. And have considered themselves to be good stewards and relatively low-impact users of the region. They're not, you know, doing commercial harvest. They're doing very small-scale gathering for personal use. But they did agree, you know, to identify some of the areas that are important to them and to share that information with the public. Other areas and other information they were not willing to share. They consider it confidential. And so, you know, really what we're providing to you is only what they've been willing to share and make public. And we've done a lot of back and forth validating with them on what exactly they are willing to share. So we worked with them. They did hand-drawn maps of areas of importance, identified some of their collection activities. We worked with the GIS staff to put that into GIS form. And then we went through a validation process, as I mentioned, to bring that information back to the participants, ask them, did we get it right? Can we make this public and share this with the stakeholders? And the final representation that I'm going to show you in these maps is really a synthesis of the input of a variety of members of these groups that participated in the workshop. We basically just sort of synthesized their information and shared with you what we could. But I just want to really make it clear that what's presented in these maps, these are obviously still draft maps, but it's really just a subset of the information we heard at the workshop that we can share with you, and it's a subset of their real use areas because, you know, obviously the workshop only represented some individuals. We don't have good coverage throughout the region, especially in the central and southern part of the region. So this is very much a subset of traditional use areas. And these maps are still draft, and we're still working on them. So if you want to just take a look at the maps, you can probably see it better than the screen. But essentially, we only got information from the northern three subregions, so from Point Arena down to about Limantour Beach. And the maps really just show the portion of the coastline where individuals identified that they do some collection activities. And then in the call-out boxes, it names the locations and identifies some of the marine resources that are gathered at those sites. And again, this is a subset of the full range of activities. This is a map of subregion 1, subregion 2, and subregion 3. You can see that in all of these maps, there is, you know, quite extensive use of the coastline. And again, their uses are primarily just that, along the coastline, fishing from shore and gathering along the shore, not so much out in boats or in the water. And so just to reiterate some of the key points here, you know, this is, again, sensitive information for the tribes to share. We really appreciate all of their effort to participate in this process. A lot of the information they don't normally disclose is its traditional use areas. And some people chose not to participate or not to let their information be made public, and we respect that. And obviously you need to keep that in mind when you're looking at this information and just constantly be remembering that it's a subset of their actual uses. And that you should consider potential impact to tribal users in your deliberations. There's definitely overlap among these areas they've identified and some of the gathering of resources that they've identified and some of the proposed MPAs that are in your draft concept. So it's something you should definitely keep in mind. And again, just keep in mind also that it's not complete. And we are really going to be working over the next couple months to try to improve this data set, get a little bit more information, get a little bit more information shared both in this northern region and then try to fill in a bit more for this southern region that we don't really have any information. And we'll hopefully at your next meetings or work group sessions have some updated maps to share with you. And I'd like to just invite Nick to add in if there's any additional comments or thoughts you want to share.
Yeah, just like to mention that, you know, I will be here for the next couple of days, so if you have any specific questions about these maps or some of the ideas that came out of that meeting, I'd be happy to answer them for you.
Thanks,
thank you,
Nick. And I really just want to acknowledge all of the tremendous help that Nick and Nelson gave us in preparing for and carrying out this workshop. There's no way it would have happened without that. So moving on to our next topic, there was a lot of interest at the last two RSG meetings ago in the concept of special closures, and Susan Ashcraft has some information on that topic.
And I don't have a presentation for this, just for the video folks. As you recall, a subgroup was formed from within the RSG to discuss how to handle bird disturbance and marine mammal disturbance issues and to come back to the greater RSG and make recommendations. We finally were able to get a call together, but not all of the people on that group could participate. Six members were able to be on the call, primarily representing vessel activity needs from commercial and recreational fishing, from nature trips and kayakers and so forth. So we couldn't identify a time when conservation and agency interests could also participate on that call. Nonetheless, we decided to have the call anyway, but the group unanimously considered participation by those interests to be vital to working through the topic and generating recommendations for the RSG. So the group on the call agreed that we would try to convene briefly with those other individuals during this meeting just to plan next steps, and I have offered to host a working session so that we can get together in person and actually look at specific areas along the coast that that the work groups may recommend by the end of this meeting. So what the group requested was that if we assume that this is going to be done in conjunction with MLPA, and that's an assumption that some people on the call did question, but if we do assume that we're going to that this would be pursued in conjunction with MLPA, then there were some key considerations that group thought should be contemplated, including what existing special closure types of closures are already in place under Marine Mammal Protection Act or other legislation and laws, and that the group should be mindful, or that everyone should be mindful of what those existing closures are, so that there wouldn't be so much inconsistency between them, those and something contemplated here that could lead to confusion by the public. And that example was that Marine Mammal Protection Act refers to 300 feet, and that's what's currently in place at the Farallon Islands and Alameda Rock Wall. So then they would like to, they are asking that in your work groups, that if you want to contemplate special closures, that as with the department's memo, to consider them, to use them sparingly, and to that they want to be able to look at specific recommendations. So they would like to see what specific areas and what specific regulations you would put in place, you know, boundaries and either distance or specific boundaries, what ecological goals you would be trying to achieve, and for which particular species. And I think that was the primary. And how, I think the other part, if I'm looking at Francesca, but, and how protections are needed in addition to those that are already existing under current jurisdictions. So the group is willing to do that work session, but they are requesting the specific proposals. They want the group to take into consideration navigational and transit hazards, and they would like to see data that supports specific sites needed and what the biological purposes are justified in those data.
Great. Thanks very much, Susan. Jason.
Yes, thank you. Oh, that's what you're going to say, huh?
And so one addition to that is the SAT provided a table, which is part of your handouts on it's a draft table on the seasonality of sensitive life stages for different birds and marine mammals. So be sure you use that as you discuss that topic. That will be discussed at future SAT meetings and looked at by the full SAT later.
Great. Thanks very much, Jason. Francesca, if I could, I'm going to ask if you could hold your question until after we do the next presentation. That's agreeable. So Mary Gleason has a final presentation for this set. This deals with an exploratory Marxan analysis, and I will let her explain what those words mean.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you about an analysis that was done as part of a master's student thesis group project at UC Santa Barbara's Bren School of the Environment and Management. So this is the work of those students, and I'm presenting it for them. And first question is, you know, what is Mark's End and how is it relevant? And Mark's End is essentially a software tool that's been employed in a number of MPA planning efforts around the world. It's an optimization tool that tries to help people understand how to balance the trade-offs between ecological goals and more socioeconomic goals, or, you know, capturing habitats that you want to include in your MPAs while minimizing impacts to different economic activities. Some of the RSG members early on, I think the June or August meeting, asked if we could use Mark's End or have it available or have some analyses done. And it turned out this Bren student group was deciding to do this as their master's project, so we sort of worked with them to make sure they were using all of the same data that you guys have been looking at and doing the analysis. So this presentation is really, you know, a result of their work. And they weren't able to be here today, but they're watching and they're able to answer questions and help us understand their work to the extent possible. And really, in this context, Mark's End is an exploratory tool. It can provide insights into some of these areas that can contribute to your habitat goals, you know, while minimizing economic impact. And it's in this context being used, you know, just that in an exploratory fashion. This is not an MPA plan they're proposing. It's not any kind of recommendations. And this is also different than the way that the SAT Parallel Processes Group is using Mark's End. And thinking about using Mark's End as more of an evaluative tool, or using it in the evaluation process to help them understand, you know, how your proposals compare to what might be considered an optimal solution. So I just want to make sure that you understand that this is distinct from the SAT's effort, although the SAT has been involved in providing some guidance to the students. So again, Mark's End is a software tool, and it's working to find the most efficient set of planning units that meet the conservation goals that you put into the model, and in this context, it really focused on habitats, with the minimum cost. And by cost, in this case, we're meaning potential impacts to commercial fisheries. That was the only sort of cost factor considered. And it's looking to do this most efficiently in the least amount of area. So it's a GIS-based tool. They're using all the same spatial data on habitats and socioeconomics that you guys have been looking at. They divided the study region up into five half-minute blocks or planning units, and really we're focusing on looking at optimizing trade-offs between the biophysical goals, which are habitats, and socioeconomic factors, which were commercial fisheries. And you have in your packet a document and a set of maps from the Bren students. This provides a two-page overview of how they did the analyses, and then there's six maps using different model inputs, and I'll kind of go through those for you, but you should maybe just take a look at the packet so that you don't have to try to see the maps on the screen. Okay, so first some important caveats. You know, again, the Mark's End output presented here is not an MPA plan. It's not meant to be prescriptive. These students aren't sort of advising you on where you should be designing MPAs. They're really trying to identify for you which planning units show up most often in the model outputs, depending on what inputs that you put in. And it's really, again, just additional information for your deliberations. Not that you don't already have enough, but this is just sort of another way of looking at things and a way to really try to look across all of those data layers, both habitat and commercial fisheries at once in sort of this optimization process. So here were the inputs to the tool. Again, it was conservation targets, and these were all of the habitats that you have been focused on, that the SAT evaluation is focused on. Stratified by these bioregions, the North, South, and Farallon. So they're kind of structuring things the same way as the SAT analysis. And then on the socioeconomic side or the cost factor side, we're just looking at the commercial fisheries data from EcoTrust because that's the data that was available. And not to say that other types of socioeconomic data could not be incorporated in the future in other runs of the model, but these outputs are really just focused on commercial fisheries. They aggregated the data from the 34 sort of port fishery complexes into an index of importance for each planning unit. So the index of importance of commercial fisheries, and that's weighted by revenue. And then they set conservation goals, and these are percentage goals for each of those habitats. And why did they do that? The first, you know, essential reason is because the tool requires it. You have to tell it, you know, I want to capture 10% or 20% or 30% of each of these habitats. So you have to set some explicit goal. They decided to set low, medium, and high goals, and those amounted to 10, 17, and 34% of each habitat. And they arrived at those numbers by using the SAT size and spacing guidelines. They could have just picked, you know, even numbers like 10, 20, or 30, but they decided to really focus on the SAT guidelines, in part because this tool doesn't really, you know, address size and spacing in any other way. But they set the low goal based on the minimum size and minimum spacing, and that would essentially amount to about 10% of the study region in MPAs if you just set that minimum size and spacing. The moderate goal was the maximum size and maximum spacing, and that's about 17% of the study region. The high goal is sort of based on the maximum size and minimum spacing, which would amount to about 34% of the study region being captured in MPAs. So those were the goals that they used. And then the output is what's called a summed solution, and it's essentially really just the number of times a planning unit is selected in multiple runs of the model, 1,000 runs. So they're looking really at the places that really kind of light up or come out as being selected very often. And so there's three sets of maps produced that you have in your packet. The first really just includes the biophysical target, so it's not got any socioeconomics in it, and it's looking at, you know, what planning units would really sort of pop out at you if you were trying to set aside 10, 17, and 34% of each one of these habitats. And we'll I'll show you that map in a minute. The second set of maps really focuses on what the tool is best at, which is, you know, optimizing the trade-offs between biophysical and socioeconomic factors. And again, the socioeconomic is just commercial fisheries. And again, it's setting those same percentage goals for each of the habitats. And then the final map is sort of something different that they've done. It's called a cost threshold, where they're really looking at, you know, they set a 100% goal for every habitat, but they also set a constraint on the model saying we don't want any commercial fishery to have more than a 10% impact. So where are the places that really light up where we can capture the most habitat and have only up to, you know, 10% commercial fishery impact? So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the maps. We can, you know, talk about them in more detail later, but I'll just go through them pretty quickly. Again, this is just the first set of maps, which are the biophysical habitat goals only. The map on the left is 10% goal, and you can see from that, if you have a relatively low habitat goal of 10%, there's a lot of planning units that you could put together to you know, contribute to a 10% goal. So there's no places that really light up as being critical to meet that goal, because the model doesn't have to work very hard to find 10% of the habitat. Conversely, on the right-hand side, that's the 34% goal. The model has to work pretty hard to find planning units that will enable it to efficiently capture 34% of all of the habitats. So what you see in that graph is that, you know, basically the cooler colors are places that are selected, you know, less often than the hotter colors. So the red planning units are selected most often. The white ones aren't selected at all, and the blue ones are selected, you know, not very frequently. So if you look at this graph on the right-hand side, you know, the model's really working the hardest to try to meet this large 34% habitat goal, and it's identifying places that it can capture lots of different habitats in the smallest amount of area. And so these aren't necessarily places you want to put MPAs, because there's a variety of other factors that you're considering, but it is instructive in identifying some places that for whatever reason seem to have either a lot of habitats, so a complexity of habitats, or they have a lot of rare habitats. So it's, you know, the model has to go there to capture those rare habitats. So it's just informative in the sense of, you know, where are the most efficient places to capture habitats. The next set, this is the set of maps that are focused on that trade-off between biophysical and socioeconomic goals. And again, you know, the white, cooler area planning units are selected less frequently. The red, orange, and red ones are selected more often. The 10% goal is on the left. The model's not having to work very hard to capture 10% of the habitat. That's where it goes to try to capture that while minimizing impacts to commercial fisheries based on the EcoTrust data. On the right-hand side, at 34%, the model's obviously having to work a lot harder to meet the 34% goal and to balance some of those impacts. And so just again to point out for you, this does not tell you necessarily where you should be putting an MPA. There's a lot of places identified. If you look, for example, at the mouth of the Golden Gate, you know, that's a place where there's a lot of habitat complexity, not very many commercial fisheries, but that's not necessarily some place you'd want to put an MPA, depending on your goals. And again, someplace, if you look at the right-hand map, someplace like Point Reyes is not showing up in that map. It's someplace that you guys have all been talking about and identified. And it's not showing up, I think, in large part because we really lack good mapped data for the habitat there. So the model's not seeing much habitat around Point Reyes. The model is also not looking for things like, you know, bird and mammal colonies or other types of biodiversity besides just those habitats. So, you know, Point Reyes has a lot of commercial fisheries around it, so it has a high, you know, cost impact. And the, you know, the data in the model aren't really highlighting it as a place that has biodiversity value. So you have to be pretty careful in looking at these maps and really trying to understand what they're telling you. And then finally, the last map is really this model run that identifies the planting units that would meet the maximum amount of all the habitats while keeping the potential fisheries impact to 10% or less. And again, this is some place, you know, the red places are again places that have probably the least commercial fisheries impact. And, you know, again, aren't necessarily places that you want to put MPAs, but there might be some instructive value here in really looking at, you know, why are certain places coming up and other places not. So, again, this is really just an exploratory analysis for your thought and deliberations. Just wanted to, you know, again, just summarize, you know, this is not an MPA plan or even recommendations from these students. They were happy to do this because there was interest on the part of the RSG in doing this kind of analyses, and I think, you know, they want to follow along in this process and provide additional support and information as you're interested in. And again, you know, I think the most important thing to just remember is that Markson is, in this case in particular, is only looking at habitats and commercial fisheries. It's not weighing and evaluating all the other factors that you all are deliberating with. So it's quite simplistic in that regard. Okay, so it's not looking at recreational uses, it's not looking at tribal uses, it's not looking at you know, water quality issues or a variety of other parameters that you are having to integrate in your deliberations. And then finally, I just wanted to say thanks to the Bren students and their faculty advisor, Bruce Kendall. I think they'd be happy to, you know, work more on this or talk with you more if there's specific interest in following up on any aspects of it.
Great. Thanks very much. That was a very cogent presentation of a fairly complex topic. We wanted to now invite comments or questions on the four presentations, the Goal 3 evaluation, tribal uses, special closures, and the exploratory Marksan analysis. And I have started a queue. Francesca is up first, and then Eric will fill me in on who follows. Francesca, I think you had a piece on special closures.
This is more of a recap and not so much a question. The call that we had on Friday was with me and Tom Beatty, Joe Yokomizo, Jay Yokomizo, sorry, Jay, Ed Tavasef, Tom Matush was there in spirit, John Malloy was on the phone, Mick from the Superfish was on as well, and we were sorry that we didn't have Karen and Irina and some other folks. I did want to recap that what was covered was that we actually wanted to communicate to the RSG that we unanimously agreed that the information coming from Sarah Allen and Mr. McChesney should be treated as guidelines, just like the SAT guidelines, and that in order to use them, again, we're not going to be creating MPAs that are all the preferred or recommended size, but that we're considering the eco habitats and the ecosystems when we're considering their guidelines. So it's not a general blanket rule, but it's more of a design consideration. And that we wanted people to be very serious about applying this as a design consideration. And that as opposed to the work group having to do more work, if there were people who had specific proposals that were very intensive with respect to no disturbance, that those come forward in a specifically outlined proposal to a specific site, as opposed to everyone here having to do an additional amount of work for which none of us have a lot of time. And the other recommendation was that since we do have to winnow down to the 3 to 5 draft proposals, that we recommend that this no disturbance conversation, as it needs to continue, be focused after this meeting. And if there needs to be discussion as a work group for no disturbance, that that happens between the second and third meeting. So between the finish of this meeting and the next RSG meeting, which is in March, because otherwise we're not able to thoughtfully look at everything that we need to.
Thanks, Francesca. Excellent, excellent report. So I have Ben Kellex, Ellen, Ed, Shanti, Ken Jones, and Tom Beatty, and Bob Breen. Ben.
Yeah, on the same topic. Since the department, this is a question I am assuming for the department or initiative staff. Since the department issued that memo, I think it was just after the Gwala meeting, what efforts have you guys taken to get Coast Guard, BLM, and those specific stakeholders that would be impacted by no transit, no anchor zones, what efforts have been made to bring them into the process?
Those entities will be brought in, and the department decided to wait until there were specific proposals established that could be brought to them to so that they could give specific feedback on the different types of proposals.
Yeah, I guess I'd just urge you, like all of us here, you know, you got to have an interaction. So when we're designing these, if we're designing these special closures, it helps to have these people here with us to bounce ideas off of. I'm afraid it's going to be too late.
Both those entities have been invited and chosen not to be here and to be available, and they have come to some of our meetings, but in our initial outreach, they did not send a specific representative to be at every meeting.
You can correct me if I'm wrong, and I may very well be, but in that initial outreach, I assume you were contacting stakeholders to talk about MPAs. These are not MPAs. These are something else. So when you did contact them originally, did you let them know that, hey, we might be creating areas where you can't take a boat or you can't anchor? Was that explicit to them?
I think the process in general was what we talked about. No, it wasn't that specific. But we said we'd get them involved when we did get specific. So okay.
Yeah, just my concern is things have changed a little bit, and I think you got to reevaluate getting those people here.
Yeah, I wonder, a question for Ken and Susan, would it be worth perhaps reiterating the invitation or reconsidering how we invite them?
I think it would make sense for us to pursue feedback from them before the next RSG meeting, when you'll be taking recommendations coming from the working group and crafting final proposals. And even though somebody needs to turn off their BlackBerry. It's my brain thinking.
Please check your BlackBerries or iPhones if you have them and turn them off.
Thank you. Thanks for the mind meld, but really. Where did they go? The thoughts. So we will do that before the next meeting so that as you're crafting final proposals, you'll have feedback from them. I hope if they're responsive to our requests specific to no-go zones. And part of that will also be talking with the Coastal Commission. We have representatives on the RSG, and we have asked them to provide some input on the policy implications for the Coastal Commission.
you know, this is, the special closures are not a requirement of the MLPA. They're effectively a parallel process that, this RSG has decided that they are committed to doing. And so, but the planning that is happening outside will always come back to the RSG.
Yeah, and I didn't even think about the Coastal Commission, and they're here. But I don't know who else there is. I mean, Coast Guard's obvious. BLM seems obvious with the Coastal National Monument. And then there's the eco-tourists, you know, that some of them are here, party boat operator. But I don't know who else. I mean, I'm sure there's other people here that could generate a good list of those that are obviously missing.
Well, the good news is there is a work team that's established. They take their charge seriously. They've given some good advice, which, Ben, you have reinforced. So this needs to be an ongoing conversation. I want to do a time check. We had agendized 11:40, which is in 2 minutes, for the presentation of the updated external proposals. And we have a few questions still to take. But please be mindful of the time, because it's important to hear about the updated proposals. So next I have Kellex.
Thank you. My question is, Mary, about your presentation about tribal uses. And I wanted to first thank the I-Team staff and Nick and Nelson who put time into this, because for me it's very useful to see this visually represented. And as you said, Mary, a lot of the tribal uses are, people were basically saying it's the whole coast, so it's hard to identify where those are or their relative priorities. But I'm noticing that since I think the ribbon idea is sort of off the table at this point, I see particular impact to tribal uses in some of the draft proposals that are shaping up in the Point Arena area and the Gualala to Salt Point areas. Mm-hmm. And that's of concern to me. And I was wondering if you have a sense, I know that your analysis couldn't allow this at this point, but do you have any sense from your conversations of the relative significance of some places more than others?
Yeah, you know, we asked the participants that in the workshop to sort of rank the importance, and essentially almost all the ranks we got were high. I mean, they were sharing with us the places of higher importance that they felt that, like, they could share. And this does represent, you know, sort of the overlap of numerous individuals providing input. So there are some pretty long stretches, but I think it does reflect the fact that they, you know, they use multiple sites in long stretches of the coast, like this Gualala section on the first page here. So it's, you know, it's hard. I think as we get more specific proposals, perhaps out of this round, we can work with Nelson and Nick to try to figure out a way to try to get maybe some more specific tribal input, kind of more reactive as proposals are coming forward, get their sort of reaction to potential impacts. Okay. And get a sense of that importance by that mechanism.
Then a follow-up question is, I guess for Fish and Game staff, is there a way that you would weigh the ability to protect these tribal uses versus the feasibility of the ribbon concept?
That's a policy. I believe that really delves into the policy arena that the BRTF can help to.
So can we put that on the list to ask them how they would weigh that? Thanks for guidance for us. Thank you.
Very good question, Kellex. Thanks. Ellen.
This also relates to the tribal use areas that were mapped. Given that all these areas along the coastline appear to be important, whether they were mapped as important or the confidential areas that were not indicated on the map, it seems clear that all of them are important. And there was an earlier discussion about you know, perhaps the department working with tribal users on whether or not we could still cite SMRs along the coast, but have an MOA that would continue to allow tribal uses of those areas. So I kind of want a report back on whether that's still a possibility, or whether we should instead in our work groups be thinking that we're then constrained to considering these as only SMCAs along the coast, or what are other options in terms of, you know, not just siting, but the protection levels we can afford, you know, that would still allow for tribal use.
Ellen, so what you're requesting is a Fish and Game legal analysis, or?
I know that we had asked earlier what the possibilities were. In terms of, say, an MOA that would allow tribal use within an SMR.
Right. This is linked to but slightly different than the question that Kellex just asked, but they're very much related. Another good question. Ed.
Just on that subject, I believe that I asked for the tribal exclusion, and I think if John Yukrish was here, he would tell you that it didn't go very well, that they thought that, in fact, it were an SMR is no take, and that was the definitive answer that he'd given. That's just to clarify that. It had been clarified already. And also, I'd like to go ask you, Mary, could you check on the definition of the regional, by biogeographical region borders? I kind of remember, I thought it was conception to arena, but you're saying conception to Oregon. I can't remember. I read so much, but if you could just remember, check that out.
So let's get an answer to question two from Mary on regions, and then I think Susan wants to loop back on the prior question. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think the biogeographical region was identified as Point Conception to Oregon, but acknowledging that there are some, other biogeographical patterns within that region, some distinctions.
Okay,
and so the master plan is actually, I think could use some clarification on that, but it does identify Monterey Bay and I think Point Reyes and Point Arena as some divisions within that biogeographical region.
No, I was referring more to the act itself. I think defined it as, and this was the MLPA, not the MLPAI, so I don't know if there was a difference or a change in the master plan after that. That defined the border from Conception to Arena and from Marina to Oregon border. Did I read that wrong or something?
We can go back and try to clarify that. I don't recall it that way. But
Susan may know.
Well, the Act does identify the two broader biogeographic regions that you reference. It also gives authority to the Science Advisory Team, the MLPA Master Plan Science Advisory Team, to evaluate what are appropriate biogeographic regions, and then other considerations for subregions within that.
Oh, no, I realize that had to do with the evaluation practice, but I'm talking about replication parameters. I just wanted to redefine define to myself or clarify what borders actually were in the Act. So I just didn't know if there was a change in the MOU or what, or in the master plan, excuse me.
And the regions are different from larger biogeographic
regions,
understand
but that.
There's a whole list of types of smaller profilings that can be considered.
Okay. Another thing, too, I wanted to bring to RSG is make sure that very clear what's being theorized or considered are 1,000-foot special closures that have to do with the bird and mammal disturbance issue, and also realize that, and to the public as well, that these are no-go areas. It means you don't walk your dog there, you don't take your boat in there, you can't anchor in there, it's nothing. You just do not go there. Just wanted to make that very clear. And also as far as Marksand, the Marksand, from what I've experienced, what you've explained here, I would like to talk to the Breen students, at least or their advisor, and see exactly how they came up with this, because the way a lot of us are reading this, it's almost like the opposite of what the results show. Excuse me. So I think I'd like to find out and have some more clarification on how they arrived at these conclusions here.
Okay. I'm happy to take a first stab at it, maybe at the break, just kind of going over the maps with those that are interested, and then we can certainly get the Bren students on the phone at some point.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Good. Mary. Thanks, Ed. So I have Shanti. I have five more speakers. Let's loop back to Susan, and then we'll continue. Go ahead.
Thank you. And I am looping back to the issue of tribal uses and state marine reserves. And the feedback that we had and repeat is that there aren't exemptions that can be made for tribal uses within the definition of an SMR. So an SMR also includes no removal of shells, et cetera. What can be done and what's needed is to specify that within an SMCA that specific what tribal collections can occur, and it needs to be very specific about what allowances are being provided, and then the science advisory team can weigh in on what the associated level of protection is for that activity, which I'm not sure I have an answer on that from the SAT. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Susan. So we have Shanti, Ken Jones, Tom Beatty, Bob Reen, and Francesca. Then we're going to move on to our next agenda item. Francesca's spoken already. Good. Shanti.
Great, thanks. So on this, bird and mammal protection issue, I think, Francesca's dead on that, you know, the SAT has identified this as something that they're going to evaluate, both in terms of no disturbance and forage. I think it is something where there are, the guidelines are being developed by the SAT to help us figure out what that might look like. I think it's much more than a simple design consideration, though. I think, if we're looking at size and spacing, we've got habitat replication, we've got bird and mammal disturbance. All three are, you could argue are equally important in the eyes of the Act to get, to meet particular goals. I think in each of those cases, you've got to identify what it is you're trying to protect and identify which areas those are in. And I think in the same way that you do with size and spacing and habitat replication with these special closures and forage closures, you've also got to, take into account the impacts to user groups. So, to Ed's point on, identifying where we've got areas of safe harbor and things, that's clearly an important thing to look at. So I think, the request from the work group as well to limit the number and use of these is obviously consistent with Blue Ribbon Task Force guidance. And I think, in the same way that you're doing that with size and spacing and habitat replication, it's consistent in this part as well. I do have a problem, though, that they're being seen as kind of somewhat separate from MPAs. I understand there's a regulatory difference, especially with the seasonal closures, at least. But I think, in the MLPA, we're ultimately looking at using whatever spatial management we need to protect the ecosystem. I think that's completely consistent with the MLPA. I think it's what it requires. And whether you're calling it, it's a definitional issue. Whether it's an MPA, a special closure, or whatever it is, you're still trying to meet the objective of, or one of the goals of the MLPA by implementing a piece of spatial management. So, again, I think it's a definitional problem more than anything else. And I think we do need to consider no disturbance areas as a very important part of proposals. It's not this kind of outside thing that we can just sort of tack on later. I think it's a very important part. So I think, to Ben's point that we need to get feedback from these other entities, that's dead on. Let's do it. I think, I'm happy to have a follow-up workshop and call, however that works. But I think also that we do need to be considering these within the process that we're in now, within the work group process, within the plenary, not just sort of an outside thing. Good. Thank you.
Thank you, Shanti. Ken Jones.
Just a couple of comments. I wanted to thank Mary for her analysis of the Goal 3 paper. I know there's been considerable discussion among each of us as far as what does it really say? What does Goal 3 really say? What are the intentions? And when I received this in the on the internet, and when I read it, said that all draft options provide a better recreational, educational, and study opportunities than existing MPAs. My first reaction was, whoa, Nelly, because certainly it gives better educational opportunities and study opportunities, but when you're talking of a finite number of onshore access points, it certainly is a different way, has a different effect than being positive to us, or can, depending on how it's analyzed. So I thank you for those comments and clarification. The second thing was in regard to the tribal issues. And Kellick said that the ribbon is dead. I prefer to say that we might have suffered knocked down in this round, but we don't feel we're out yet. We're going to keep trying to refine that approach and work with the Department of Fish and Game, and hopefully it just seems so logical in many ways that we hope that we can continue to perhaps proceed down the road in some manner. Maybe it may not happen in this region, but perhaps when I look at Southern California, which I see as a whole plethora of opportunities down there, it may be something that is desirable. And this final comment was on this Markson analysis. and this was new to me. I appreciate the presentation. Having taught economics in high school, it's certainly we try to put a lot of things in economic terms. And one of the things, and my first reaction was this is interesting. It's kind of late in the ball game to bring this up today, when we have to try to come up with proposals by tomorrow afternoon. So it's kind of tough to you know, bring this stuff into our data bank at this point. But economic data is good. It has to include the various types of economic data. And I was thinking that, for instance, this only included the commercial fishing data. And if this came out of UC Santa Cruz, I would ask them, you know, what would be the impact if they took away those million pier fishermen who visit Santa Cruz Wharf each year, the economic data to Santa Cruz. You've got to add that different type of data in there to get a full picture of what's going on. And the third thing is, when you're talking about recreational anglers, you're more talking often about the psychological impact and the well-being of the angler than you are about whether or not they're making money, and how do you measure that, the soul of the angler and what benefits are coming from that. So I think it's great information. It's just perhaps one more tool we can take a look at, certainly not a end-all. I just want to thank you for all of that.
Thanks, Ken.
Thanks, and let me just to clarify too, Ken, that by way of the economic component of Mark's, and it's really looking using the EcoTrust commercial fishery survey, so it's looking at areas of economic importance weighted by revenue, so it does have an economic component. You certainly could use Mark's and incorporate something like the recreational survey data and just use areas of importance that are importance, you know, for cultural, spiritual, you know, catch reasons, not having to do with economics. So you can incorporate a variety of factors.
Good. Thank you very much. Tom Beatty. Thank you. Bob Breen.
Well, I have just a question on goal three, education and study opportunities. I wonder if you included the main campus at San Francisco State. There's a marine lab there on the second floor, along with most of the equipment is up there at the Romberg Center, but there are probably about a half a dozen grad students operating out of the main campus to marine biology.
Yeah, that's a good point and something we could certainly include. We sort of tried to identify places where people would be directly accessing the water. That's why we sort of picked the labs on the water, but that's a good point.
Good. Thank you. Phil, did you have a comment or question?
Yeah, thanks. My comment or question actually was about the special closures. And when I read the memo from John Ugritz about the special closures, I interpreted it as a tool, you know, to use if we were talking about an SMR solely to protect the birds and mammals or forage. And I interpreted it as a possible way to step back from an SMR and use an SMCA in an area with the special closure component in there to, you know, keep all traffic out during some seasonally important time for these species. So I just needed to know, did I interpret it wrong? Or, you know, I tried to get a hold of John on his cell phone, and he's just not answering calls, or maybe not my calls. I don't know.
But Susan is here.
Yeah, John won't be answering anybody's calls for a month. He's on vacation, so including mine, unfortunately. But no, you interpreted that correctly, and I'm glad you brought that up, and that was an alternative in particular for seasonal closures to protect birds and mammals, and that is what the information in your packet provides seasonality of specific species, and we've heard from Irina and Karen Reyna at different times which species of birds occur at which areas along the coast, and that's the information is provided to be specific to each species, depending on whether your priority is breeding protection for migrant birds when they're around, and then which marine mammals.
Good. Thank you very much, Susan, and thanks to RSG members for all those good clarifying questions. We're going to now turn to the part of our agenda where we would like to receive presentations on revised draft, what we're calling external to the work team, MPA proposals. I would note that in all cases, there are members of the RSG who have contributed to these external to the work team
proposals. And what we are particularly wanting to ask is that proponents highlight changes, that is, what's different about these proposals relative to what we've heard about at prior RSG meetings. And again, I want to emphasize that it is part of the charge of the regional stakeholder group to consider and evaluate these proposals as well as those coming from the work team process. So we have three proponents, and I hope I have this correct. Please nudge me if I've got it wrong. Dave Yarger, I believe, is going to speak on Proposal A, Dan Wolford on Proposal B, and Karen Garrison on Proposal C. And then Shanti Roberts will present on Proposal D. So, Dave, I want to invite you to go ahead and present. I don't think you have a PowerPoint presentation. Good, because we don't have it. Go ahead. But do you want to stay there and present? Okay. Please go ahead. Raise the mic.
Okay.
There you go.
It's going to be the least complicated of all the amendments. Bodega Bay Fishermen's Marketing Association stands with their original proposal as we first submitted it, and for the reasons of social economic values to our commercial fishing industry, we feel this is the only thing that we can accept at this point. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Dave. Next up, we want to invite Dan Wolford to present on Package B. And again, please highlight, if you would, the changes since we last heard about your proposal. Do you have a PowerPoint?
Yeah, I do have a PowerPoint.
It should be loaded. Hold on. We'll get it up for you.
Yeah, great. If you could just go to the next slide. I think one of the things that's changed a little bit is the Partnership for Sustainable Oceans. We've expanded our group a little bit. The National Marine Manufacturers Association is now formally a part of this consortium, and I want to acknowledge that. But our charge hasn't changed at all, basically to protect the health of the ocean environment without unnecessary closures of the coastal waters. So let's go to the next slide and really see what we've done here. We've basically taken the SAT evaluation of our proposal to heart. We've looked at the guidance they gave us. We've done things to the proposal to make sure that we scored size and spacing, got the conservation values up. And in some cases, you're going to see the reaction to that isn't probably what you expected. It wasn't what I expected in some cases. But it is what we needed to do in order to get the conservation values and the scores up. We've also had a fair amount of conversation with many of the stakeholders, and you're going to see some of that in terms of making boundary adjustments to achieve lesser impacts to some of the stakeholders and to improve accessibility. But the big thing is you're going to see a revised set of activity regulations to get us through the scoring windows, if you will. So on the next slide, you're going to see we've actually added one area to our matrix. It's a SMCA. We've now got seven of those, a total of 16 MPAs in the proposal. We're still at around 17-18% of the study area in various MPAs. Let's take a look at the regulations on the next chart. This is where we made the big changes. The areas now are very explicit in terms of the SAT guidelines of what is to be allowed inside the areas. SMRs are still obviously no take, but the SMCAs, the allowed activities, are now expressed in terms of SAT guidance, specific guidance. So you'll see salmon trolling, but not salmon mooching. You'll also see then those other activities, herring, sardines, anchovies, Dungeness crab, and squid. You'll see that list replicated quite a bit throughout here. And so with those, you'll also see on this list that Saunders Reef is added, is the added SMCA, the second one down here. And in that particular area, we've also got urchin added into that standard list of allowed activities. So I think let's take a look at the changes we made explicitly. This is the area in the Point Arena Saunders Reef area. We've made a boundary adjustment to the Point Arena Reserve, largely moving that southern boundary northward to improve the access in the south. And in so doing, the conversations with the stakeholders up there suggested that perhaps Saunders Reef would be a way to augment that that area. But it is a very important urchin harvest area, and so we have included that activity as part of that. So the trade-off here was to move that southern area of the Point Arena boundary northward and then include a Saunders Reef area. At the Black Point on the next slide, this is just a slight boundary movement. Everything slid a little bit north, but it did improve some of that access south of, improve the access south of, in the southern area around Stewart's Point. We still have excellent habitat coverage here, so this was a fairly minor shift in terms of distances. At Salt Point, we made no changes. This is consistent with our original proposal. At Russian River, again, the very small SMR at the opening there at the Russian River was, again, a no-change area. At the area of Bodega Head is probably the first really significant area that we modified. I want to call your attention to the fact that we did modify that boundary on the northern part to improve the access of the shore-based anglers. Rather than taking the reserve all the way to the coastline, we ran it due north of that point, and we squared up all the boundaries here so they run north, south, east, west, and incorporated then the SAT guidelines about what allowable activities would be allowed in these areas. But the big change here is in that beach area where we do allow improved shore access. Point Reyes and Drake's Estero, there were basically no changes to the boundaries here, although we did allow very explicitly to conform to the SAT guidelines about allowed activities. At Fitzgerald, the halibut fishery here is just excruciatingly important to the recreational fishermen. We made a boundary adjustment to allow that. And this is an area where the SAT guidelines, how you group a conglomerate area, caused us to do some things that probably surprise you. This area is actually smaller than it was on the initial proposal, but we believe now that it will fit within the size and spacing guidelines. It does match the conservation values about what activities are allowed. And whereas before it wasn't counted at all because we allowed halibut fishing within the area, we've now excluded that area from the zone. So we think this will now count. We'll get a conservation score for it. But it's probably not the kind of adjustment you expected to see. But it is what the guidelines caused us to go do. At Farallons, this is the same geometry that we proposed before. We've revised the activities to conform to the SAT guidelines. So those are the changes that we made. So if we go to the next slide, we'll just summarize it. We still think this is a very valuable plan. We think it's going to contribute to the quality of the proposals that are taken to the Blue Ribbon Task Force. We hope it goes there, and we're proud to submit it for consideration. So I'll take comments at this time.
Dan, thanks very much. What I'd like to do is actually get through the next presentation and then welcome comments and questions on all three. So thank you very much for your presentation.
Just to clarify, that was B, external B?
That was external to the work team B, yes. Lots of nomenclature in this process. So we want to hear next from Karen Garrison, who will be presenting on behalf of Proposal C.
Hi, everyone. Can you hear? Okay. Let's see if I can handle that. Hi, everybody. Okay, so I'm speaking for Package C, and Package C is supported by the Center for Oceanic Awareness, Defenders of Wildlife, Friends of Fitzgerald Reserve, Environment California, various coastkeepers and baykeepers, some other groups that I can't even read, Marine Mammal Center, NRDC, and others. The sponsors of Package C share a common goal of the RSG, namely, we want to leave the ocean a thriving and healthy place for generations to come. Package C did a good job of meeting the biological guidelines in the first iteration with just a few exceptions. But we learned a great deal from the evaluations, and most of that was about how to do the job more efficiently. We clearly had work to do to reduce the potential socioeconomic impacts of this proposal, or package, as we call it. So we zeroed in on those changes doing several things. We dug into the EcoTrust data and tried to sort out what was happening in specific areas. We searched other arrays for areas that achieved biological goals at lower costs. And most importantly, we had a lot of conversations. We literally sat down with local residents. We talked things out. We learned a lot from them. We made sure that we were listening to local voices. And after significant revisions, we think we've made good progress in reducing potential impacts. In the revision process, our priorities were set by the goals and guidelines of the Act on one hand, and by the desire to better address the interests of communities and reduce impacts on the other. First, we aimed for a network anchored by areas of high protection in the preferred size range. And that's important because it allows a network to function for the broadest range of species that are likely to benefit, and it gets to the biodiversity goal. Oh, where did this come from? Gets to the biodiversity goal. Well, it looks like my revised proposal didn't make it in here, so well, you'll just have to live with that. These are going to be a little out of order. The current C has three high protection areas in the preferred size range, and another where we didn't achieve that goal, we got several minimum size close by in the high protection area. Second, let's see if I can find any of the relevant slides. Okay, here's the one about the cluster sizes. I actually meant to do the high protection here. We had one very big one. That's now squarely in the preferred size range, but I think we still do well on that goal. Second, we aim to represent and replicate a full habitat spectrum. The first version of C got off to a good start there. You can see that it did well in these kinds of habitats. It did have one set of goals of gaps, and that was in estuary and eelgrass and related habitats in the north subregion. We filled that gap with an idea that we borrowed from the Emerald Groups for a marine reserve in the south of Tomales Bay. Third, we aim to keep habitat coverage within the spacing guidelines, because that, along with size, provides the best assurance for population persistence. C performed well in this category, but you're going to have to take my word for it, because I could only find the graphs for the arrays from the GEM groups. In C, we actually made it within that 30 to 60 mile, within the red lines for all habitats. We even got that coveted deep sand. So ask us how in private. Fourth, and this is where our real work came in, we made numerous adjustments to better meet community needs and reduce potential impacts. That was really the heart of our revision effort. So this is a quick overview of the changes we made. We reduced the size of the Point Arena cluster. We reduced the size of the Saunders Reef area. We borrowed this idea for a state park from several other arrays right in the area near Salt Point and Ocean Cove. We eliminated a whole cluster of areas at Tomales Bluff, which is a very coveted fishing area as well as a high conservation value area. We added that Tomales Bay South area. We revamped our Double Point Duxbury area, and I'm going to show you some pictures of these in a second. And we reduced the size of the Farallones Reserve. So some of these pictures are unfortunately behind us, but I think I can go back and find them. On the Farallones, we borrowed this set of ideas or worked from this set of ideas from the Emerald Group. Our original proposal, Package C original, was all marine reserve around the Farallones. And the new one that we've come up with looks like this. It still has high protection in the preferred size range in the south, around the southeast island. It has more area for commercial and sport fishing through the whole center area on that northeast side that's important for rockfish fishing, and on that southeast side that's important for party boats from San Francisco and environs. Okay, with Duxbury Double Point, this was our old area, and it was not very convenient for salmon trollers running up the coast, even though it does meet Susan's request for more areas that have marine reserves going out to the state waters line. It did have high impacts, so we rearranged it, and this is what we came up with. The lower area wraps in around the existing Duxbury Reef. I think it's a park, state park, or a marine conservation area. That lower area would allow salmon and crab, both for recreational and commercial, and it would also allow commercial halibut, which addresses the needs of the small-scale halibut fishermen out of Bolinas. The upper area has a reserve out to about 10 fathoms, and then a salmon and crab area further out. Again, it's trying to address some of the existing uses. Now, I think I have to go back to get some of these other ones, so bear with me. Now, we've seen that. Okay, so this is the area we removed. I just threw that in so you could see it. It's really, really nice habitat. When we removed it, we did strengthen the Bodega area slightly by making the SMCA there salmon only instead of salmon and crab. Did I miss anything else? Okay, let's. I think this is the last one, Point Arena. Our original proposal is on the left. You can see on the right the Point Arena, the lower boundary has been moved up, and that's to allow for more boat activity and boat fishing from the harbor. They've basically got 2 good miles now. Many of the folks in the local area, though, would like to have, I thought I'd have a pointer, but can I just sneak over there and point? That Sea Lion Cove around Sea Lion Rocks, many of the locals would like that protected from abalone fishing. So that's a little addition of a reserve or an area that might allow shore fishing that I think the work group should consider. Saunders Reef area has also been shrunk. It's been moved up on the south to allow more boat access from Anchor Bay and more shore fishing. It still allows urchins on the inner side, or commercial urchins, because they're so important to the port of Point Arena. Let's see if I've been through all of these now. I believe I have. Okay, so we also did a few things to improve the feasibility of this alternative. It now has major lat long lines for pretty much all the boundaries, with a few exceptions where there are landmarks. Its uses and names have been clarified. The objectives have been added, although we're going to beef those up a little bit more. And we tried to keep it simple. As you can see from Duxbury, we didn't always succeed. But we did our best. And we had very good reasons when we resorted to a slightly greater level of complexity. So I just want to emphasize in closing that many of these conversations are ongoing. They're more changes are likely to result. The sponsors have a very deep commitment to finding a network that works on many levels and achieves the spirit of the MLPA. By incorporating what we've learned, we've strengthened C. It now has a good level of protection. It has balance. It has greatly reduced potential for adverse impacts, and it has high potential for beneficial impacts. We hope the RSG members find it useful, just as we've found the areas in the GEM group arrays useful, and we hope it helps move towards that mythical convergence that we all seek.
Thanks very much, Karen. What we'd like to do now is to turn to Shanti and go ahead, and then we'll see where the conversation turns next. Go ahead.
Thanks. So, the original proposal D that we submitted, that was done for a couple of reasons. You know, the idea was to get kind of ideas on the table, and the first thing we were trying to do there was provide everyone with the sort of ecological synthesis document that we'd put together, identifying all the important ecological areas up and down the coast with the intent of, you know, identifying what sort of ends up being protected in particular areas, but also what ends up not being protected if you fail to put an MPA in a particular area. It's also, you know, useful for when we start thinking about monitoring and identifying areas that can be compared to areas that have MPAs, and would need monitoring to identify whether those objectives for the MPAs are being being met. So I hope that's still useful to folks. I hope it's kind of in your folder still. I think the second part, of course, has got quite a bit of discussion. It's about the birds and mammals and trying to get proper protections in place for those, both for no disturbance and forage. And you know, I just appreciate that it's really being discussed properly in the RSG work groups. And also, you know, we've got a proper evaluation plan with guidelines that have come out from the SAT. So, I mean, I really appreciate all the work that's been done with all of that, and I just look forward to continuing to work within the process. Thanks.
Thank you, Shanti, very much. Melissa?
I just wanted to add, speaking of in your packets, the external proposals that were submitted last week are actually being collated right now. They will be distributed to you during the lunch hour so that you'll have them available to you during your deliberations this afternoon, along with some additional materials.
Great. Thank you very much. And Shanti, thank you very much for all of your hard work and keeping these issues on the table. So to recap, we at the last meeting, we had four proposals external to the work team process. Two have been revised, one has not been revised, and one has been essentially withdrawn for purposes of full proposal status, but still remains a source of ideas. So already we have some movement here, but I want to, at this point, anticipating that you don't have your packets yet, invite clarifying questions, number one, and number two, any cross-cutting observations that RSG members may have about these proposals A, B, C, and D. So I would welcome any clarifying questions or observations at this point. Ben.
Looks like Karen and our group talked to the same people in Point Arena.
And they gave similar information. Good. Ken?
I just want to thank all four groups. I think that you've all given a lot of time and effort and energy in your proposals and certainly added a lot of thought and ideas that we can use in the groups. So I just appreciate it. I want to thank all of you.
Thank you, Ken. I was actually going to add another question for the RSG is if you want to weigh in as to how you think you might incorporate some of these ideas as you revise your GEM group arrays. We'd love to hear that as well. Other comments, other observations? Tom?
Yeah, question for Karen. The external proposal C, you left out the Point Reyes headlands area in your description. Maybe you could just give us a verbal from where you're sitting.
Is this on? Yeah, it didn't change very much. We, I think, raised the southern boundary of the reserve northward a bit, and then we wrapped it up a little higher around the west side. Otherwise, it's pretty similar. It's just barely in the preferred size range. It's an SMCA that allows salmon and crab and a fairly small reserve around the headland.
Good. Thank you. Any other clarifying questions or comments? You're all very quiet and thoughtful here. Ed.
I'd just like to say, Karen, yeah, that's very interesting. You have some interesting material to work with there. Thank you.
Thank you, Ed. Bill Bernard.
Actually, the question is directed both to Ben and Karen. Up the in the Saunders Reef area, you were mentioned that you wanted allowed or not allowed use was the abalone. Is there a particular reason why you want to avoid to have the abalone removed from there?
I'll go first. Bill, I think I think it was a mistake on our part. I think it was omitted accidentally, given that we're allowing urchin, and I kind of keep getting all these numbers and levels of protection messed around in my head, but I think an urchin was the lowest of two, even though there's no numbers or whatever.
Ben, when you
anymore.
Say our part, you're speaking now about B.
B, So that's if they'll allow us to make a change. That one makes sense, Bill.
Good. Karen,
and
go ahead.
From our perspective, for Package C, really what we would have liked is to anchor the network with a preferred size high protection area. But because of the harbor, we decided to have a minimum size above the harbor and a minimum size below. We decided to allow urchins because it's over 50% of the revenues to the harbor, and we really didn't want to interfere with that. At the same time, we wanted to get as high protection as we could in that area. So in Package C, the SMCA near shore does allow commercial urchin only. We made that decision both because of the importance of urchin economically and because there's a very few people doing it anymore. There's one or two, three people doing it, so we think it's a low level. We hope it's a low level impact.
I still don't see where the abalone there would be detrimental to the ecosystem there, because it, we haven't got the impact back from the abalone part of it, the Silkie's economics. But I would also ask you to consider in the long-term management plan with the abalone resource, such as like Sonetta, if we would been on the abalone resource, we've been on the long-term plan, we've actually could have, been aware of the situation and reduced the actual number of take in the place on a right off the bat. We could have gone anywhere from zero take there to all the reduce it all the way down just in one individual. So that's something I want you to all, everybody here, there are considerations in these fishery plans that we're supposed to be, working with at the same time, and it's to understand those.
Thanks, Bill. Phil.
Thank you. I just wanted to add a little perspective about the abalone diving at Saunders Reef. It's basically non-existent, and I've, been living there for 10 years. I happen to live very close to Saunders Reef. I see it almost every day, and I've never seen a boat drive down to Saunders Reef to pick abalone down there. So if it raises the score to keep abalone out at Saunders Reef, it's just my perspective that it's not going to have a high impact on anybody.
Thank you. So any other RSG members want to weigh in on these proposals external to the work team process? Ed, go ahead.
I just wanted to know if maybe the team can work up the numbers on maybe we don't really have to have the Saunders Reef included as a full protection or high level. It can be maybe we already have reached the requirements of the MLPA, and perhaps we can justify allowing low-level protection within that particular SMCA. Can you do that, Jason? Would that be possible to work something up like that?
Well,
as far as size and spacing and habitat representation?
Just to be clear about the cycle, what we're trying to come out of this meeting with is five proposals that would be subject to the next SAT evaluation. So I-Team, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe there will be another interim evaluation of a slightly tweaked proposal before tomorrow.
Right, that's correct. We wouldn't be able to pull that in before tomorrow.
You're right, right. So we really need to go with our current information set and RSG members' best judgment as they craft these revised proposals. Right,
right.
Right. But and then there will be, of course, another SAT evaluation. Ben.
Yeah, just to comment on that, Ed. That's exactly what we expected, that Saunders Reef one, it's not going to be a factor in size and spacing because you allow urchin, kind of kicks it out. So something to consider. Yeah.
Thanks, Ben. Karen.
Yeah, I think the Saunders Reef area seems important to leave in, even if it doesn't score in the network configuration, because it does provide some protection for both benthic and rockfish, stuff that lives on the bottom. And it's in a different position relative to the upwelling than the area up near Arena Rock. So it seems like it can add something useful, even if it doesn't count in the way that things are scored.
Okay, so I understand that.
I'm going to invite Ben to respond. I assume you want to respond to this. And then, Tom Matush, you have your card up, and that will close our session. And then we'll take lunch.
Yeah, just a quick comment kind of on what Karen was saying. you have this area like Saunders Reef where you're not allowing ground fish, and you know, to get SAT feedback that says, well, basically that doesn't count, you know, I think most of us, you know, sitting here realize, well, that's going to have some kind of positive benefit. So I think that's where the parallel process modeling work can yield some pretty interesting results, I think. I've seen some of the early work, and it's areas just like that that the modeling work, I think, will demonstrate that they do have considerable benefit. So hopefully you guys will make every effort to give us some of that information as it becomes available.
Good. Thank you, Ben. Tom Matouche.
Okay, I'd just like to ask everybody also to consider, when you think about some of the bird and mammal regulations, there's a number of fish and wildlife regulations, both seasonal and distance-wise, that are in effect now. And the Marine Mammal Protection Act being one of them says a 300-foot limitation. I believe that if you go any further than that, you'd be actually violating Goal 3 of the educational and study opportunities of looking at marine mammals and birds. There's a number of people in this room that have a great deal of experience in operating vessels, and we can tell you that many times we can get very, very close to these animals, either intentionally or unintentionally, depending on the situation. And we don't spook these things. So I would urge everybody to take this into consideration and not create something that isn't needed and may deprive the public of educational and study opportunities.
Bob, you have a final, concise comment?
Yes, just very close. Twice people have mentioned that the Marine Mammal Protection Act has a 300-foot limit, and it only does for one very small population of stellar sea lions at the Farallones. The Marine Mammal Protection Act is a do it at your own risk. It prohibits taking, which includes harassment, but it doesn't have specific guidelines that will satisfy you, except for stellar sea lions in that one particular area. But I would also say, I think this goes to closures. One of the things that's being considered is that people who do know how to approach and have experience in wildlife could possibly do that in a closed area with permit. It's the people who haven't had the experience and know how to do it that's caused some of those problems. And so that is an area that's being explored that we're talking about as part of the closed area, is permitting for those areas for people who do know how to do it.
Got it. Thank you, Bob. At this point, we'd like to go ahead and close our morning session. We'll adjourn for lunch, and we'll plan to reconvene at 1:15. Are there any other announcements that iTeam staff want to give as we go to lunch? Lunch is located where?
Lunch for our regional stakeholder group members, primaries and alternates, is downstairs in the Cove Room. It's down near the front desk. For members of the public, we do have a restaurant here at the hotel, as well as a couple of restaurants, one just downstairs, another couple across the street. And also for regional stakeholder group members, you have referenced a number of times the vast amount of materials that you continually receive from the iTeam. And in case you have a desire for additional binders or tabs to organize and hold that information, Delbra has brought several boxes full of binders for you. So please see her at some point today, and she'll provide you with one.
Good afternoon. We'd like to ask you to please get your coffee and settle in. We'll be beginning public comment in a minute or two here. So the reporter is interviewing a lot of people. All right, we'd like to reconvene here for the afternoon. We'd like to ask members of the regional stakeholder group to please take their seats at the main table here. Still a little light on regional stakeholder group members. Well, if there are RSG members in the hall, please make your way inside. At this point, we'd like to ask members of the public who would like to address the regional stakeholder group to stand up and raise your hand, and we will count you, and we will figure out the available time. Looks like about more than 2 minutes apiece. All right, we are going to ask you to try to be very concise and give you about a minute and a half. I know that's not very much. Eric is going to be our official timer. We don't have our festive Christmas tree timer. And I realize that this is asking a lot of you to convey your interests in a minute and a half, but please be mindful that you have 21 other fellow citizens who want to speak. So we're not going to have speaker cards, but anyone who would like to kick off the speaker queue, please go ahead and introduce yourself. Go ahead, approach the microphone, introduce yourself, your name, and where you're from.
One other process note, I will be keeping time, a minute and a half, and I have a one-minute sheet here that I'll shy this way just to help you know.
Share, pooling time is encouraged. It's fine.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Clive Endress. I am a member of Havens Neck Preserve. In the past, I have asked you that you recognize that we in the Havens Neck Preserve share the same goals for you for the preservation of our oceans and marine life. I've also asked that you recognize us as a vital partner in this process. Recently, I spoke of what it has meant to me to share the outdoors with my family and my friends, and most importantly, the value that the outdoor experience teaches our younger generations. Today, I promise I will not show you any more home movies, pictures of my kids, even though I think they're very cute. Instead, I want to impress upon you the importance of maintaining a reasonable fishing ground for recreational fishermen, both north and south of the Anchor Bay Havens Neck area, Saunders Reef, and why this is especially important to the north. And now I'm going to try and shorten this because it was way over a minute and a half, and just say I'm heartened by the comments I've heard today regarding Saunders Reef and the access to Anchor Bay Beach and the area north. My concern is that many of us that fish in the area need to go north in the morning just because of the heavy weather. We need to come home with the winds behind us, heading downhill, not beating upwind into the sea. It's a matter of safety, and I hope you will consider that in your considerations for the MPA. Finally, I just want to make another note, and I talk about us who fish occasionally, and I think the key word here is occasionally. Myself, just like most of you in the room, are very busy. We have full-time jobs. We're raising families, remodeling the house, and so on. We all have demands in our life. The fact is, most of us who fish can just squeeze in one or two trips a year, and I'll leave it at that. I implore you, these few trips we get, please don't take these opportunities for beauty, adventure, excitement, and these memories away. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's have our next speaker just go right ahead and approach the microphone. Again, your name and where you're from.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Marcos Underwood. Okay, sorry. My name is Dr. Marcos Underwood. I'm the chairman of the board of the Havens Neck Reserve. We are encouraged by the recent changes to the external proposals BNC. As you know, the preservation of Havens Neck and its environs is the main purpose of our LLC. We are hopeful that other stakeholders will also follow suit in their respective proposals and extend a safe area northward for small fishing boats launched from Anchor Bay. We recognize that the coastline in our area is thriving with marine life, yet our coastal economy is very fragile. Therefore, we are very concerned about the socioeconomic impact of banning shoreline recreational activities along with neighboring coastlines. We feel many of the coastal property owners in this area are responsible stewards and want to be partners with you in ensuring the goals of the MLPA. They can provide a level of protection to the surrounding marine life, typically beyond what the government agencies can provide. Our group of 20 families is in a very good position to protect Havens Neck and the flora and fauna on it and the surrounding beaches and rocks. Unfortunately, the DFNG is not as well positioned to protect Havens Neck marine life due to its more limited enforcement resources. As a further complication, severely limiting the available legal fishing area will cause economic damage to the surrounding fishing community and may also lead to an increase of illegal fishing, further taxing its limited enforcement resources. Because of these and other reasons, I'm asking that the respective stakeholder groups involved with the GEM proposals to reconsider the manner in which they are evaluating the need to further protect the marine life around Saunders Reef. In conclusion, I'm thanking everyone involved for the consideration that has been shown to us to date. I'm also asking that the evaluation process for selecting areas to be protected include the effects of responsible stewards and considerations for the resulting socioeconomic factors that compromise the model predictions. I remind you that we're willing to be partners in this activity. To further help you understand who Havens Neck is, I have copies of our mission statement if anybody would like to see them. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and do leave those with the I-Team staff. Go ahead. We'd like the speakers to continue.
Just some brief comments on the special closures.
Your name, sir, and where you're from.
Excuse me, Matt Keller from Sonoma County. I have interest as a commercial fisherman, but also as a recreational kayaker and bird watcher. And I'd like to suggest that in Susan's meeting with to examine other interests in the special closures, that some things, some groups she might include are the Madrone Audubon Society and the California Waterfowl Association, the various kayaking renters along the near the various ports. I think all of these people would have good input into restrictions on access to various areas. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir, your name and where you're from.
My name is Tim Fromm. I'm from Half Moon Bay, California, and my provincial area of concern is the San Mateo Coast. I'm a steelhead fisherman, 55 years old, been steelhead fishing in Pescadero Lagoon my entire life, learned the sport from my father. It's a catch and release, barbless, 3-day a week during a limited season for steelhead. when we became aware that there, a couple of the draft proposals suggested that Pescadero Lagoon Estuary become a state marine reserve. It alarmed us greatly because we knew that that would eliminate our opportunity to recreational catch and release fish per current fish and game regulations. And I'd like to suggest that we're actually, I think, more of an asset than a liability down there. We raise money as a steelhead fishing group. We advocate for restoration. We put boots on the ground, actually working the labor to implement restoration projects. I encourage you to reconsider, and for some type of designation would allow the continuation of catch and release steelhead fishing in Pescadero. As a second point, I also striped bass fish on the sandy beaches of San Mateo Coast. When we're striped bass fishing, there is no bycatch. We're specific to the species. Striped bass on our sandy beaches are not listed as one of the species that benefit from a marine protected area. And if possible, the continuance of allowance for sandy beach fishing would be greatly appreciated. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I see a line is formed. That's good. Very efficient. Go ahead. Your name and where you're from.
My name is Harry Vogel. My occupation, commercial fisherman. I'm an ex-commercial abalone diver. I harvested commercial abalone from 1969 to 1997 when a 10-year moratorium closed the fishery. During those years, I worked mostly from Pillar Point Harbor in Half Moon Bay. The most popular reef that I and most divers chose to harvest was at the Farallon Islands. The reason the divers targeted the Farallons was due to the abundant and sustainable population of abalone existing there. During those years, the abalone remained at an abundant, sustainable level due to the method of harvest used by the commercial divers. This method is very selective, has no habitable destruction or bycatch. The divers also worked in cooperation with research groups out the islands by keeping off the rocks and beaches as not to disturb the bird life and mammal life, out the mammals on the shoreline. Also, during the early 1990s, a cooperative written agreement was made between the California Abalone Association and research groups to stop all diving activity during bird nesting and mammal pupping seasons, and this was adhered to. Also, the dive boat owners invested in changing to noise-free compressor exhaust systems to avoid any flushing of birds.
Thank you, sir.
At the time of the 10-year closure in 1997, the abalone resource at the island was abundant. Due to this fact, I, along with many other commercial boat divers, boat owners, invested in upgrades and new boats and equipment for safer operation at the islands. And now, after 10 years of closure, the divers and workers associated with this fishery are still waiting to return to work at this island fishery.
Sir, I know you have more words. I would like
There's
you
only
to...
One, I got one more paragraph. This 10-year moratorium sunsets this year. The divers know and have witnessed to large abalone populations existing there. Also, the Abalone Association is now in the process of requesting the California Abalone, California Fish and Game Commission for a collaborative transit study at the Farallons. This study between California Fish and Game personnel and trained transit study divers of the California Abalone Association and any other qualified group interested to participate is our goal of Abalone Association divers to reopen a safe, sustainable fishery at this location that has been a fishery since 1950. Thank you, Harry Vogel.
Thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Greg Barron. I'm with Incredible Adventures. I
run one of the ecotourism outfits that are out at the Farallon Islands, and I'd like to discuss the possible closures, but first I'd like to thank Ben, Francesca, and Tom for bringing up that subject earlier, because I hadn't really heard that discussed much in the last four meetings, I think. Basically, I'd like to remind everybody that, I guess, one of the goals of the MLPA is to improve recreational and educational opportunities. We need to be there because we help with that. We promote the various operations. We promote the stewardship of the islands. We work in, and or we work with educational opportunities. We help enforce the informal rules that are out there now. We bring biologists out. We bring equipment. We bring people. We educate them. So we kind of are a good thing. We'd like to stay working out there if we possibly can. We're low impact. We basically anchor and watch. So that's another thing. There also is a socioeconomic impact. You need to keep that in mind. There's a whole lot of us that work out there, and we like our jobs too. So keep those in mind, and thank you.
Thank you very much.
My name is Don Stupfel, ex-commercial abalone diver. Would like to go back to work. I've been diving commercial abalone since 1970, starting at the Farallon Islands. It's a very productive area. The abalone out there seem to grow twice as fast as they do on the mainland shore. It's a wonderful place to dive. It's always pretty clear and abundant with sea life. I took early retirement from high school teaching to dive full-time, but then I was shut down 10, 12 years ago. I would like to continue, and I would like to continue diving in the Farallon. I feel I have a stake in diving out there since I've been diving there so long, and there is a tremendous return in the abalone, mainly because the sea urchin harvesting took place out there and cleared the way for abalone to grow even faster. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My name is Richard Pobre. I'm a resident of San Mateo County. I'm a former commercial abalone diver working out of Pillar Point. At the time of our abalone closure in 1997, we had 20-plus commercial divers working out of Pillar Point. We have a long history of fishing the Southeast Farallon Islands. We have a history of working with other groups that monitor and observe bird and sea life on and around the islands. We have very little impact on the area, and we respect the resources that the islands hold. We are limited to the amount of time that we have visits to the island because of the season, weather, and water conditions. Our traditional fishing area is the Moronga Bay southwest area, east around to the boom slot, back around to Fisherman's Bay and to Main Top area. At this time, the Abalone Advisory Group is formulating a San Miguel fishery plan, and after that was to be completed, we were supposed to move to the Southeast Farallon to do our transect studies and density studies. The fishing game was out there recently and reported back that the islands are healthy with abalone, with robust abalone populations of all sizes. To close off the island to responsible fishing practices and access to the commercial abalone fishery would likely mean the end of the decade-old part of the fishery in California. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Jenna Kinghorn, and I live in Montara. I'm a member of the Board of Directors of Friends of Fitzgerald Marine Reserve, where I've been a volunteer for a number of years, and I also edit their newsletter. I'm a member of Friends of Fitzgerald Marine Reserve, and I'm here today because I think the reserve is a very special place that provides an amazing outdoor educational experience for students of all ages. I want to help protect it for future generations, and I hope to get your help in doing that. During the process of designating marine protected areas for the north central coast of California, I urge you to provide the strongest possible protections for Fitzgerald Marine Reserve and extend the reserve's current boundaries north to Pedro Point and out 1 nautical mile to sea. Extending the boundary north provides protection for the unique deep, soft, sandy bottom and boulder field habitats found north of the reserve's current boundaries. And I know that preserving unique habitat is an important goal of the MLPA process. I've been at the reserve several times and witnessed a fast-moving boat come close enough to disturb resting seals and seabirds, and I hope that extending the reserve's boundaries out 1 nautical mile will lower the frequency of such encounters. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. My name is Chris Arbelich. I've currently been working at California Fly Shop. It's a fly fishing shop in San Carlos for about 2 years now. And I've been fishing the shores and particularly Pescadero Creek for the last 2.5 years. And just to hear that, you know, we won't be able to go and enjoy the actual coastline, I'm pretty much speaking for a lot of the Bay Area fly fishermen who do practice a lot of catch and release primarily. I have a petition here that's only been out for a week. I have about over 55 signings here. So just to hear that, you know, we won't be able to fish, it's just kind of, you know, people go there just to enjoy and experience, you know, on their time off. We don't get to fish it all that often, especially Pescadero. It's only 3 months out of the year, and it's has a pretty tough, restrictive kind of a, you know, law where you can't keep any fish or anything, barbless hooks. But I'm pretty much speaking for everyone, and hopefully we can keep, you know, it open to everybody. Everyone's, you know, pretty adamant about, you know, keeping it open and practicing catch and release. So thank you guys, and hoping we can make this this closure not happen. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My name is Mick Menigo. I run the Superfish. It's one of the charter boats that spends an awful lot of time out very close to the islands. I've been doing fishing trips and whale-watching trips, nature trips, bird-watching trips, et cetera, out there for about 18 years, working closely with both the sanctuary and Fish and Wildlife Service, the stewards of the island. We've addressed several issues over the years. I think it's come to an agreement that works well for all parties involved as far as disturbances, things like that. And we've been working closely with the sanctuary for several years now, trying to address some current issues. I'm very concerned about this special closure. If done properly, it would probably address some issues. I think it goes a little bit overboard. But a special closure eliminating everybody from 1,000 feet or inside 1,000 feet around the island is going to remove the educational component of what we do. We won't be able to get close enough to show someone a bird, a tufted puffin or a brown booby or a Cassin's auklet or any of these things that so many people want to go out there and see. And without seeing them, they lose in the sanctuary, we talk about a sense of ownership that goes towards a sense of stewardship, a sense of caring, a sense of wanting to show more people and show them what it is that we need to save. We won't be able to do that. People aren't going to see it. We're going to say, you know, there's a really cool spot over there, but we can't take you there. And it's really sad to see that when it's really not necessary. I think that if we really need, or if you guys decide that the 1,000-foot closure is very important, there needs to be a permit process for those responsible individuals or groups that go inside there and do show people a very special area. I don't know how many people of you guys have actually spent much time at the island, but you know, I can tell you incredible stories out there, and I can also say that you can go out there and look at some very nice stuff without having a detrimental impact to the area itself. I think that the guys on the island that have been documenting disturbances since I think 1968 would have a really hard time coming up with anything that said that the commercial operators, the whale watch boats, the bird watch boats, et cetera, are having any negative impact. I think that we need to look very closely at perhaps a way of permitting these operators.
Thanks very much.
All right. Thanks a lot. Well, thanks for your consideration.
Hi. My name is James Mosquito, here for Shark Dive International, Great White Adventures. We're the eco-tour company that takes guests out to the Farallones to view the white sharks. We promote the MPAs out there, and just would like to continue to provide access to the general public to these islands. It is a very special place, one of four places in the world where you can actually view the white sharks. We've been working with the sanctuary directly with the permit process. We've been working with them on a verbal permit that we've been established and using for the past 6 years, so that's already been in place. We are for permitted access. We promote the low-impact observations that we do on the island. And just say that this is a special place. This year alone, we took 864 people to the island to view white sharks. This is a small number. It was about 50 days out of the year. And these people come from all over the world. I have people from Ireland, the UK, South Africa, Australia, to view these special creatures. So we continue to like to do this opportunity, these observations, and continue to provide access to the island for the general public the way we have been doing in a very low-impact operation.
Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you very much.
My name is Barbara Emley, and I'm a commercial fisherman for salmon and crab. And I wanted to make sure everybody understood that what that means is that fishing is my job. It's how I get enough money to pay my bills. I buy my health insurance like the rest of you, pay my mortgages. And over the years, fisheries management has made a serious dent in the ability for those of us who still fish to do that. And those of us who are still in the industry have our own particular strategies for getting around the situations created by fisheries management. And any further restriction seriously impacts the ability for me to maintain my household. The Gulf of the Farallon Sanctuary did a study showing that the number of boats delivering into the three harbors in the study area, Bodega Bay, San Francisco, and Half Moon Bay, at the time the study was started was about 2,000 boats in about 1993, and the number who had delivered by the time the study was over in 2003 had gone down to 600. We are declining in numbers, and anything you do here is certainly not going to help. But we hope you take that into consideration when you make your decisions.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Good afternoon. My name is Roger Thomas. I represent the Golden Gate Fishermen's Association. Probably about 10 of our 50 boats do eco-tours to the islands. I personally own and operate a boat called the Salty Lady, and I do about 50 trips a year, mainly for the Oceanic Society, carrying some 2,000 people. And they're very important trips. They're very educational trips. On a personal basis, I worked out the agreement in 1984 with the Fish and Game Commission, California Fish and Game, Fish and Wildlife Service, and PRBO on the present restrictions that are now in force at the islands, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. We support those restrictions. I would agree with Mick that they should stay in place, and a permit basis for the Eco Tour boats would be more than acceptable to all of us. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. My name is James Robertson, and I have a commercial passenger carrier vessel out of Sausalito, California. And I put together some real numbers on incidental catches. These all come out of my fish and game logbooks that I turn into the state, so all these can be verified. I did the last 6 years. For 2002, I ran 159 trips. 85 of those were in less than 150 feet of water, and 74 in more than 150 feet. I carried 3,228 passengers. If you figure fishing 5 to 7 hours, that's 15 to 20,000 hours of fishing. The incidental catch for that year was 5 halibut, 1 striped bass, 2 lingcod, 19 rockfish, 1 white sea bass, and 3 barracuda. In 2003, I ran 156 trips. And in less than 150 feet of water was 75 trips, and more was 81. And I carried 2,865 passengers. And I had 6 halibut, three striped bass, six ling cod, and 49 rockfish. For 2004, I carried made 179 trips and carried 3,552 anglers for a total of four striped bass incidental, 42 rock cod, 2 flounder, 8 mackerel. I know I'm running short on my time. I did make copies. If anybody wants
That's
to
great.
Look at these, these are real figures. You can check my fishing game logs.
Good. Please do leave them with the I-Team staff. Thank you very much. Right at the table. You're there. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Hi. My name is Larry Collins. I'm president of San Francisco Crab Boat Owners Association, the oldest commercial fishermen's association on the West Coast. I'm also the vice president of PCFFA and serve on the California Salmon Council. I've been a commercial salmon, crab, and rockfish fisherman for 25 years. I fish out of Fisherman's Wharf in the city. I have a 46-foot boat. I make my living going to sea and harvesting the public resource. I represent not only my fellow commercial fishermen, but the fish-consuming public that owns this resource. That's all of you. I believe this whole MPA process is a solution in search of a problem. Fisheries management is designed to do everything you imagine MPAs will do and more. Fisheries management has kept me from fishing from 20 to 150 fathoms for rock cod for the last 13 years, half of my career. Now the ocean is lousy with rock cod. Will MPAs guarantee there will be rivers for salmon to spawn in? Will it get a crab pot limits instituted in California? Will they keep agricultural and city pollutants from flowing out of SF Bay? Will they keep oil spills from happening? Let's talk about the latest oil spill in San Francisco Bay. Would MPAs have saved the 3,000 birds from oiling? Would they have stopped that oil from traveling to Tomales in the north and Pedro in the south? No, they would not. Crab Boat Owners was able to put 21 boats with experienced captains on the water to clean up that spill. Our guys, over 4 days, cleaned up tons of oil that would have gone on the beaches, rocks, and in the eelgrass. Those boats and captains were only available because there is still a remnant of the commercial California fleet. This MPA process is a knife in the back of our fleet. I'm almost done. The American public owns the fish resources in this vast ocean commons. The commercial fleet gives the public access to the resources they own. Forming MPAs deprives citizens of their access to their fish. Basically, by closing off the ocean waters, you are stealing the people's fish. I've seen reallocations of resources before, and this is no different. Fishermen out of SF Bay have been working these waters for over 100 years. These waters are extremely healthy and productive. That's because fishery management works. If you close off Duxbury, Point Reyes, or the islands to the fishermen and consuming public, you will turn me into a criminal because I will keep fishing these waters to feed people. It seems to me that an MPA is like an oil spill that is never cleaned up. It has the same effect on the fishermen and the consuming public. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Jerry Norton, and I come to discuss this one page here that I left with you during lunch. And maybe I can just hit the top parts of it. The Anchor Bay Campground LLC is an inheritor of 75 years of sustained recreational fishing and diving at Anchor Bay. And we have some concerns about having part of our sustained area cut off and going into an unsustained state thereby. And I want to say right off the top that we've talked to the people who submitted Outside Proposal C and Outside Proposal B, and they've been very helpful to us. They've listened, and they've been helpful, so we wanted to be sure and acknowledge that. The handout has 2 pages. The first page has some economic facts about Anchor Bay, and the second page has some biology and oceanography. I'm not going to talk about that, but I'm a biology oceanography guy. So I included that. Now, these economic facts, they're presented as ranges, and all facts should be presented to you as ranges like this. As time goes by, I'll try to focus in on these and give you a little narrower range, but at present, I'm 95 to 98% sure that we're within that range.
Thank you, Jerry.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Duncan McLean, and I'm president of the local Fishermen's Association. What you see here in this room are stakeholders. What you've embarked upon violates the trust rights of all the citizens of California. Marine reserves are intended to impact only fishing people. Fishing, while certainly exacerbates a problem, it is not the problem. In fact, it is the only barometer in existence to identify ocean problems. You're reneging on your trust responsibilities with what you're doing here. How does this stuff control non-point source pollution, plastics, aquaculture, oil spills, etc.? If you want to do the right thing, you have to address the right issues with real solutions. But my question here for you today is, if your entire future security rested on the success of this process, would you continue on this course? Because it appears you have no trouble in taking mine away from me. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. My name is Mike Flynn. I'm a property owner at Island Cove Estates, 5 miles south of Point Arena, which falls within the proposed Saunders Reef SMCA. I'm an abalone diver and a shoreline fisherman. Our group of property owners have been good stewards of our oceanfront and have a very low impact on ocean resources. Although private property owners, were not included in the MLPA stakeholders, we arguably have a great deal at stake in the decisions that this group is poised to make. With regard to the Saunders Reef SMCA, I urge the stakeholders group to include abalone and shoreline fishing in the final allowable activities in this area. These activities have had a very low impact on marine resources and are very important to local populations and to the value of our properties. I ask at a minimum to please allow us to continue to pick abalone and fish from the shore. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. My name is William Smith. I run the CPFV vessel Riptide out of Half Moon Bay. For sake of expediency here, I will just say that I endorse comments that Mick has made and Roger Thomas in regards to allowing us to either get special permits for accessing the Farallon Islands. And then on the other part of this is that I am a commercial passenger fishing vessel. I would ask all commercial passenger vessels and commercial fishermen who do this for a living to please stand up. Would you please do that for me? These are the endangered species.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Lori Schuyler, and I'm with the Havens Neck Preserve. And we are very heartened by the changes in both B and C that we heard today. It means a lot to us in the public that our concerns are being heard and incorporated into proposals. And we are very encouraged that you are listening. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm Walter Radcliffe. I'm just north of Havens Neck and Sail Rock Ranch, LLC. I represent 14 owners up there. I was here a couple of weeks ago to talk, and we've been stewarding the property in the near shore area for 80-plus years. There's very little take in this area, in this mile of coastline. We've been essentially the larval dispersers for the area south. And one thing I notice is we really have a lack of timescale data, so I'm not sure if 40 years from now we're going to be in a different place. But in any case, there is a fairly big overlap between what you've done in terms of leaving coastline open and closing coastline that's been closed for a while. I'm looking at the maps. There's a great alignment. So it seems like public access is going to be honored, but the areas that are currently locked up are going to continue to be locked up. The areas that are open are going to continue to be open. So if you take a time slice on this and look 40 years out, I'm not sure if you're going to be gaining anything. I'm just here to ask, with Proposal B and C, that you allow us to continue the very meager take of abalone and rockfish from shore fishing that we're currently doing without impact. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any other members of the public that who would like to address the regional stakeholder group? Does not appear so. Okay. We're close to on time. Let's consider our next steps here as we go into the afternoon. We told you at the kickoff to this meeting that we definitely heard the message that there was a request to spend a little more time in work teams. Some of you have done that. The Jade Group has not. And Eric, I think you had another topic you wanted to briefly touch upon before we tee up the work team activity.
Thanks, Scott. There have been some discussions that have been taking place amongst RSG members and staff over lunch with regard to what's the best way of addressing the special closures issue in our work groups today and tomorrow, given that it adds a level of complexity to the work that we've been doing in terms of coming up with MPA arrays. And this is a layer on top of that, and arguments can be made both for doing it in conjunction with MPAs because to a certain extent they're linked. At the same time, they also operate somewhat as a separate process with a subgroup that is being set up to continue to look into that work. And there's perhaps wisdom to be gained from utilizing a separate process, a subgroup process that would examine these issues, and that group could then report back to the full RSG rather than having the three work groups operating in isolation on this. And so I guess I wanted to open this up for some brief discussion. It would be nice to have some clarity additional clarity from staff to the RSG members on what's the best way to approach the special closure issue so that you can operate as efficiently as possible over the next several hours. And here, I guess I wanted to just ask if the department or other IT members want to weigh in.
I think what's getting confused in here in this mix is that is the SAT analysis component of any special closures that are for purposes of bird or mammal protection. We've heard from the SAT evaluation subgroup that if a special closure is proposed to be year round, then it will be analyzed the same way as a state marine reserve. So independent of that, it won't alter the analysis of that the SAT brings forward relative to the types of information you've received thus far. They will be providing input on what species are being protected and what type of protections are being afforded to different bird and mammal activities. It won't necessarily, though, change any of the kind of size spacing, goal three analysis, and so on that you've heard so far. So I guess one of the things we talked about at our table during lunch was that if there are areas that you wish to consider as a year-round special closure, at minimum it would be helpful to propose that as a state marine reserve, and then so that it goes into the analysis as a state marine reserve, with the articulation that what your intentions are, and that can be kind of evaluated with the added layer on top of it, because we called it kind of the super SMR, if it's actually a no-go zone as well. There could be options for interested members in your working groups that have a strong and passionate interest in pursuing additional protections for birds and marine mammals. The disturbance subgroup has said that they're interested in receiving specific proposals. And I think that the department could help to host, in addition to a discussion with the bird disturbance group, would be willing to meet with members from the some members from the different groups that have specific proposals in mind for or for specific areas they wish to be considered, so that that can be done outside of this process, and that as work groups here, you can focus your time on the other elements that will go into the SAT analysis and DFG feasibility analysis and need BRTF feedback. And I think we could do that in time for coming back to the March meeting, so that anything that needed to move forward with final proposals would be able to be embedded at that time.
Good. Thanks very much, Susan.
That's just one approach.
Those are some ideas, and I think Mary Gleason wants to elaborate on those a bit.
You know, I agree with Susan, and I think the issue is really that we're sort of struggling with how to accomplish what we need to this meeting, which is to get these draft MPA proposals put together, as well as deal with all the special closure issues. And so I think the idea of having this work group, the disturbance work group, and we can, you know, if you're not in that group and want to be, we could certainly add members, really wrestle, you know, separately with the disturbance issue and come back to the main group with some proposals, some options that they could consider. We can have even a conference call or another work session just focused on that topic. We can kind of keep it in this same process, but, you know, a little bit separated from the MPA proposal evaluation process. And the staff are going to be working with Sarah Allen and Jerry McChesney on developing their methodology for how they're going to evaluate protection to birds and mammals from the MPAs and special closures that are proposed. And so that's ongoing. We're really just getting that underway. And so there's still plenty of time to, you know, propose special closures and work through an evaluation of them before the January 23rd SAT meeting. And at least have some sort of initial ideas and initial evaluation by then, and then, you know, further develop them through the March RSG meeting. So I guess the thought would be today and tomorrow not to dwell so much on the special closures, but to punt that off to this separate work group that would tackle it and bring something back to the plenary.
Good. So the concept introduced by Susan and Mary is not to try and shoehorn this parallel process into the next day and a half, but to take the five proposals that emerge from this meeting, five or fewer, thank you, Ken, and to make available this discussion about special closures, which would happen in parallel, offline, but then converge back with the proponents of the proposals. Okay? All right? Good. Other thoughts, other suggestions? Shanti?
Thanks for trying to figure this out. I know it's not particularly easy. And I know we want to try and get the size and spacing and the habitat replication part of the SAT evaluation down for these proposals today and tomorrow. It sounds like, if I understand that the SAT evaluation here, it's, you know, if you put into place a year-round area for protecting birds and mammals from no disturbance, it's going to be way too small for counting in a SAT evaluation for size and spacing guidelines anyway. Probably, those guidelines are for a different purpose. I think it sounds to me, at least, that what's being developed by Sarah and Jerry are an additional set of evaluation, or a different way of evaluating, and the guidelines that are associated with that for this specifically. So I wouldn't expect any, you know, sort of SMRs, if it was year round, to be evaluated for this specific purpose. For the size and spacing perhaps. I just want to see this thing, you know, in it. I want to see it kind of included in the discussion. If we've got to put together a work group to do that, let's do that. I just want to make sure, and it's especially the case if the evaluation and guidelines element of that is not fully developed at this stage. I mean I'm happy to do that.
Thank you, Shanti. I also have Irina, Dave, and Phil, and maybe others. Irina.
Yeah, so this is just a clarification question, make sure I understand correctly. So it sounds like that the subgroup, so then we basically wouldn't really worry about special closures during the next day or day and a half. But then the subgroup would meet in time to kind of discuss this issue, discuss potential proposals or additions to proposals, and have something in time for the January 23rd evaluation. So there'd be the potential to get feedback on how this works, whether this actually, you know, these various closures, how well they would protect those species, that kind of thing, before the final round. Is that right?
Yes, and essentially this sort of, you know, next round would be developing the SAD evaluation methodology for these areas and developing these areas, getting input from the department and these other agencies that might need to weigh in. All, you know, essentially over the next 6 weeks, getting some initial inputs and then recrafting them as more final proposals for the March deadline.
Seems good. Like a reasonable idea.
Good. Thanks very much. Dave Yarger.
Okay, there. You just had to turn me up.
All right.
As the person that proposed option A as the external proposals, I've had some direction from quite a few of the fishermen in this room and in my port to maybe discuss a blending. But before I would make this proposal or request on the floor, I would like to at least spend a short period of time with all the subgroups, with Emerald and Turquoise specifically, because I'm also a member of JADE, and I would like to make a presentation to them before I blended my proposal. Is that possible?
Well, we've set aside most of the afternoon for work team activity, and I'm sure that you could find a slot of time to visit both this afternoon. So that seems very more than possible. It seems like a good idea. Thank you, Dave, very much. Yes, I think we should definitely accommodate that, and we'll work with you to schedule that and make that happen.
Well, I don't feel less strongly about the position I've taken, and it sort of is indicated by the testimony you had from public testimony. But I am open to some flexibility here as long as it doesn't adversely impact our fisheries.
Good. Great. Thank you. Thank you very much for that. Phil.
Yeah, I just had to clarify what I said earlier about Saunders Reef, because what I was not talking about was the whole SMCA that I see on most of the maps. What I'm talking about in regards to not much abalone pressure is at the offshore part of the reef itself, because it was may have sounded like it was in direct conflict with what you heard with public testimony from Mr. Radcliffe and Mr. Flynn.
Good. Thanks, Phil, for that clarification. Ben.
I'm sure I've just missed it, but is there a list of the activities that are not allowed in a special closure, like walking on the beach or owning the cliff house or other things like that?
You know, my understanding, and I welcome Irina to correct me immediately, is that there is a fair amount of flexibility, and that's part of the purpose of having this conversation, is to explore what that flexibility is. It's not a blanket and uniform answer in all cases. Irina, do you want to elaborate?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's exactly right, and just kind of referring back to the recommendation that came to the sanctuary from the Seabird Technical Advisory Committee. I mean, a lot of the sites that were seen as like the biological hotspots for seabirds in this overall region they're in our regional profile, they're map 5A, and most of them, they're not on beaches, next to beaches. They're, you know, tend to be remote rocky headlands, or, you know, the area right now that's a big concern is the islands. So as far as coastal access or people walking on the beach, I mean, it's basically boating access. I think that's going to be the biggest issue around those, and trying to figure out some sort of flexible way to be able to protect the resources and allow for human activity. So it's pointing out the fact that there are these sensitive resources. This is a hot spot for them, and how can we protect them from disturbance while accommodating various things like navigation issues and safety and ecotourism. So I think that's the intention, is that it's a conversation to try to figure that out? Like, what's the way that we can make this work?
And I apologize, I'm probably behind the curve here. What you have is for seabirds.
Yes.
Not marine mammals.
Right. That information is for that we presented was for seabirds, but in the regional profile, there's a really nice, also a really nice graph for marine mammals and rookeries and haulouts that we could also use to inform us for that.
Because some of those, there are human uses on the shore, whether it's a beach or an intertidal area. So I'm just wondering, you know, don't we need some information from the SAT as to how they're going to evaluate it, have that documented and scientifically vetted, so that we know if we say, all right, you can't surf at Mavericks anymore, you know, that we know it's going to be achieving something. Has any of that been vetted yet?
So the sequence, as I understand it, is to have these work team come up with proposals, incorporate them in full proposals for the region, and have that be part of the SAT evaluation. Is that correct? Is that the sequence that's contemplated here?
Yeah, I mean, I would say they might not necessarily be incorporated fully into the proposals this round, but by the end of the process, yes.
By the end of the process. I didn't mean this round.
Yeah.
Right. So I guess what I hear Ben asking for is, can there be an evaluation of these closures kind of independently of an evaluation of a proposal? Is that one of your questions? And I don't know if that's contemplated or possible.
Yeah, and a thorough documentation of the evaluation method.
No, I understand methodologically it's possible. I meant in the flow of SAT evaluation and
We're working through a preliminary methodology that, you know, obviously having a set of proposals to test it on will be helpful and to get it vetted. You know, it's hard to sort of talk about that in the abstract, but once, you know, if this work team can generate a few options of proposals, then the SAT can do the evaluation and get it vetted to the full SAT.
Okay, so this is my final comment on it, and I'll throw it against the wall, and nobody else has to respond to it, but God, this seems premature. I mean, it seems like there are so many questions about special closures that have not been answered, that have barely been discussed, and we have, what, one or maybe two review cycles to review something we don't know anything about yet. We don't know any of the methodology. I mean, this just seems really, really out of place.
Well, just going to the tool of special closures, without a doubt it did come up in at least Jade's group, which I know best, but I think in others. So it certainly has come up a lot. Several members of the RSG have expressed interest in using it. I think you and others have asked the SAT, or asked rhetorically, so what good is it if it, you know, how does it factor into the size and spacing analysis? So those are all live questions, and what we're trying to figure out as an I team is how to, you know, make this idea concrete and useful and have it evaluated. And this is the best idea we've come up with so far. Maybe we can do better.
And I would agree. I mean, I don't want there to be any confusion. I think that a special closure could be a very valuable tool, especially for birds and mammals. But what I don't think has been done is all the homework. You know, we've spent years on MLPA now on the Central Coast and here developing kind of the rules to play by. We're talking about developing the rules here in a couple weeks.
Well, it's been vetted for a few months. I mean, we've had some questions. The SAT has done research on specific topics related to this issue, and we have a draft methodology for how to evaluate proposals. So there is a process in place, and having some specific proposals to evaluate is the best way to test that methodology and get it vetted.
I've said my piece.
Good. Thank you very much. Phil, Tom Beatty, and Ed Tavasiev. Phil.
Thank you.
And then we want to move on.
Right. It's I had a sidebar conversation with Susan about the special closures, and I don't know, the SAT probably hasn't had time to evaluate the question, but I just rewrote it, and I think if I ask the question, it might be, you know, hypothetical enough to maybe answer. Maybe we could get a little more clarification on it. But so the question is, how would the SAT evaluation change at a place like the Farallon Islands if there was an SMCA around the Southeast Farallon Islands out 1,000 feet from
the high tide line that allowed for, say, commercial abalone diving under ground rules developed under the ARMP, or Abalone Recovery and Management Plan. And fishing, you know, for abalone would occur under a special permit issued by the Gulf of the Farallones, also permitted by the Department of Fish and Game and sanctioned by the Fish and Game Commission. And the example would be a donut-sized shape around the island and offset that size by slightly enlarging the circumference of the SMR. And in this scenario, the protection of birds and mammals could be facilitated through seasonal special closures that would protect species for fledgling and pupping and foraging, et cetera. So it's sort of a question.
Phil, I can barely see you behind John, who has great hair, but I really it's blocking you over here. I just want to say that's the kind of question that is very appropriate to bring up in this subgroup setting that would then go forward to this SAT group and staff for analysis at that point. So I invite you to actually participate in that work group.
Well, the only problem with that is that the question isn't going to get circulated around all the groups. That was my concern. So maybe they could just make some sort of statement if it's feasible.
Can you, Phil, write that question down and submit it to staff? And it's a compound question. Compound and hardly articulated question, but why don't you submit it and we'll see if we can get that into before the SAT. We have Tom and Ed, and then we really need to move into our next agenda.
Yeah, Tom. I wanted to address a point that Mary made in her comments, and that was regarding the the task of this working group regarding the special closures. And having participated in the conference call on Friday, it was crystal clear that one of our recommendations to this group was that any work that the group does was in regard to specific proposals for closed zones. In other words, not to wallow in criteria or that sort of thing. That we need specific, at this stage in the game, that without specific proposals, we're dead in the water. We're just going to be chasing our tails. So those proponents of the special closures areas need to step up and give us something to work with.
And I think ideally they would be part of that group. They would be bringing specific proposals to that group.
Absolutely.
Be part of that group.
Good.
So
thank you.
So if you're not in that group and you want to be, you should talk to Susan today.
Good.
Ed, are you in that group?
Yes, I am, and I just want to.
Good.
Yes, I am. I just wanted to say yes. One of the requirements that we didn't, or one of the pieces that we were missing at our meeting was we didn't have informed information. We were lacking information from the people that were we were hoping to be there, and so we need information to give us informed, to allow us to make informed decisions. So that's. That's including to the proposals. Excuse me, since we're going to do proposals, give us the information to let us know where this is coming from so we can understand what you're trying to tell us. And I'm not just saying just general information. If you can find information that's specific to the area, it would really help,
right.
too.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ed. Shanti?
Yeah, just very briefly. I think we can probably figure out a lot of this in the work group itself. And, The trick in the same way as it's been with the size and spacing, the backbone of this thing, the same with the habitat replication, it's going to be about minimizing, the impacts where we can. So if we, I very much doubt we're going to start picking areas with, that are next to a busy beach or that have, got houses on cliffs over top of bird colonies and things like that. That's not, certainly not what I've been trying to do, and I don't think what anybody else is trying to do.
Good.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So we want to move into work team mode. Eric, do you want to tee this up?
Thanks, Scott. I want to just thank folks for bearing with us as we went through that discussion. We understand that this issue has been causing some confusion for folks for a while, and we hope that this time spent in plenary here will actually help make your upcoming time in work groups more efficient. So a couple of logistics about work groups. We're going to be in three separate areas. This room here will be the Jade Group, and as far as I know, we may be actually working off of this screen here, so you guys can congregate around the front. The Emerald Group will be in the same room they were in before, the Sea Witch Room, and the Turquoise Group will be in Presidential Suite 434. One other piece of advice I'd like to give you, because we do want to, again, ask each of the work groups before they finish up tonight to assign which members will stay home with their poster and present, and which are the other two groups who will travel to the other posters. And also want to think about the fact that you have a really good opportunity tonight in these poster sessions to address some questions. So you may get tripped up on a particular issue that you're having trouble resolving within your work group. Well, my recommendation is flag that issue as part of your presentation to the other groups when they come to visit during these poster sessions, because maybe advice and guidance from the other work group members can help resolve those things. Bob, quick question, and then we do need to break.
Yeah, you said you were going to distribute maps during the lunch period.
Our apologies. Took a little bit longer than expected. Your maps will be waiting for you, and in the workroom, there'll be maps here for this group, upstairs in the suite, and then across the hall.
So even increased incentive to go to your breakout rooms right now. So let's break and request that this take place efficiently.
Jason.
Oh. Wait, Delbra has one more comment.
Okay, I think this message is probably for a public member. If there is a Kevin Klein here, I have a message from Jenny, so please just wave your hand and I'll let you know. Thank you.